Welcome to the X-Men Task Podcast. My name is Willie Simpson.
My name is Sonia Rappaport.
And today, Sonia, we have a very special episode. We are talking about X-Men, not the animated series.
We're always talking about X-Men.
That's right. Yeah, not the animated series. The first movie from 2000, directed by Bryan Singer.
Right.
This will be the first in a series of very special episodes we plan to do every once in a while, where we intend to talk about every X-Men movie. We're not going to do them all in a row. Next week you're going to hear back from the regular X-Men show.
Yeah, I don't know if series is the right... I guess it is a
series. Series of films.
Okay, right.
Yeah, that's the right nomenclature. So this is the first one we're going to do. Like I said, we intend to hit every movie, which is exciting. Just a word to the wise off the bat. We are not X-Men cinema experts. We are X-Men enthusiasts, for sure.
Mm-hmm. But that's about where the authority starts and ends.
Right. So if you've enjoyed our banterings and blatherings up to this point on the X-Men animated series show, perhaps you'll enjoy this trip into the X-Men cinematic universe.
Right. But, if we miss things, we're bound to miss things.
Right.
Or if you want to just, add to the conversation,
right,
please feel free to
find
us on the Facebook group, chat to us and each other, and, cover all the ground or some of the ground that we're missing here.
All right, very good. All right, so without further ado, let's start talking about X-Men from 2000. So, before we delve into the movie, Sonia, do you have any memories of having seen this in the time, in the magical year 2000?
In the year 2000.
That's right.
I absolutely do. I was 15, I think, something like that, and... it was really magical, I had grown up watching X-Men the Animated Series, and this was really the first time that Marvel characters were going to be in a movie. So I was like...
Well, the first time in a major motion picture.
Right, exactly.
Right, yeah.
Exactly.
Like, there were like real crappy knockoff type movies.
Right, but something that was like a big deal and coming out of Hollywood. And,
yes,
like,
yes, with celebrities.
It had like really a lot of promise. I was super, super excited for it. And, this movie takes some criticism for a lot of reasons, and, we'll get into that.
Yeah.
But, I thought it was just the greatest thing ever because I was so, starved for, more X-Men stuff.
Yeah.
And, I think the promise of it was that, I was not 8 years old anymore, and it felt like the X-Men
grown up.
Was growing up with me at that point.
Yeah,
as
a
nerdy teenager, I was the X-Men are still a thing, and look, they're updated and cool, and,
right?
Modernized or something. So despite whatever, I was really willing to overlook a lot of flaws in the movie, and I even got this movie on VHS when it came out. I must have been 16 at the time. A friend gave it to me as a birthday present. I was yes,
nice,
I own the X-Men movie.
Yeah, no, I had very similar reactions. And also, as we've mentioned on this podcast before, this movie was pretty much greenlit as a direct result of the success of the animated series.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a natural connection or symbiosis with the animated series and this first movie. And then really the birth of superhero movies being popular in America, and the birth of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, even though this isn't connected to the current MCU.
Mm-hmm.
They're in separate corporate worlds.
Right.
As we all know, Fox controls the X-Men universe and I guess Fantastic Four as well at this point. But and Marvel controls pretty much the rest of their properties now that they've got Spider-Man. It's the first it was the rebirth of the superhero genre.
Right.
And
I think another part of it is that now we have a lot to compare it to, so it's really easy to say this is wrong with it, that's wrong with it.
Yeah.
But this was kind of part of the birth of this genre.
Yeah.
So without having a whole lot to compare it to.
I'd say the rebirth of the genre.
Yeah, that's fair.
Because
after the Superman.
Right, Superman and Batman,
yeah.
And Batman kind of tanked,
right,
along the way there. Right, because, really, Hollywood studios didn't want to make these superhero films because of the failures of those later Batman movies that were sillier. Batman and Robin, you know, with Arnold Schwarzenegger as Mr. Freeze is pretty embarrassing and terrible.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what Hollywood thought comic books were,
right,
to a large extent. And when it failed, they're like, well, comic books, this is, you know, they suck. Like, what? No one had, they hadn't quite, I guess they knew, but they hadn't quite put together that there was a way to do them that was potentially exciting and serious and captivating.
Mm-hmm.
So this, right, this represents sort of the first major step in that direction. People will argue the movie Blade, starring Wesley Snipes, which is a Marvel property, and that was done fairly seriously, and there's lots of fans of that movie.
Yeah.
But, you know, Blade is, he's in the minor character territory. He's
right.
Not the X-Men, which is a major franchise.
Right.
And the other thing, you know, there's two reasons why this movie got made when it did as well. Because, one, the X-Men was probably the most popular comic book franchise at the time, definitely in the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
The X-Men series itself as a comic book led the resurgence of comic book stores and comic book interest in the 90s. It was like a bubble, and that kind of crashed too, but that's a different story. But X-Men was the most popular, but at that point sort of eclipsing Spider-Man and in other properties, Superman and even Batman to an extent. So X-Men was huge. And the second reason was, finally there was like a confluence of things happening in Hollywood, mainly the advancement of CGI and special effects, that made the promise of doing a movie like X-Men more possible. Because, you know, the X-Men have many fantastical powers, a lot of them in the laser energy area and explosion area,
mm-hmm.
and flying and things of that nature, like manipulating reality. So the movie technology had finally begun to catch up with what the comic books were displaying for decades, really.
Right.
So, like, those things, you know, and right before we started recording this, I just jumped on the X-Men movie Wikipedia page, and there's some interesting, like, details on there. Everyone should check it out to get, like, a more detailed summary of, like, how this movie came to be.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, you know, the production of this movie, or the desire for this movie to be made, really goes back to the 80s, which I found surprising. Orion Pictures wanted to make it. They picked it up in 1984, and James Cameron was at some point attached, but then he jumped off because he wanted to do Spider-Man after Stan Lee spoke to him, and that never happened either. James Cameron, that was a big thing in the 90s. There's always rumors about James Cameron wanting to do Spider-Man, so it was interesting to see that he was even attached to X-Men at one point. And then the film rights went through many studios, and it kept getting dropped for this reason or that. I think a lot of it had to do with cost. Potential cost. I mean, this was always going to be a big budget film.
Right.
And also, no one knew if the interest, like, could seriously be...
Yeah, it was a big risk.
Yeah. You know, and there's lots of various movie stars floated that were going to appear in different eras. Like, in the 80s, they wanted Bob Hoskins of Roger Rabbit fame to play Wolverine, which would have been weird.
Yeah, interesting.
And Angela Bassett to be Storm, and then... You know, and then at some point, you know, like we said, the success of the animated series led Fox to be interested in this as a movie thing. The movie rights themselves were bought by Laura Shuler Donner, I believe, the wife of Richard Donner, the director of Superman.
Mm-hmm.
And that ended up being a major bonanza for her. She really scored because she ended up sort of controlling the movie rights for these X-Men films for years. No, I don't know. I was just clicking around on Wikipedia.
No, it's interesting. I just like the use of the word bonanza in that sentence.
Right.
That was good.
Yeah. A real X-bonanza. It said that these movies have grossed billions of dollars, like $4.5 billion or something. And
uh-huh.
So that was like a major thing for her to be on the cutting edge of that.
Mm.
Interesting that, you know, her and her husband, Richard Donner, Superman creator, the real birth of the superhero genre with them,
mm-hmm.
you know, they carried forth with this movie. And then the movie finally, like we said, got picked up by Fox in the mid-90s. Bryan Singer, at some point was selected to direct and helm it creatively. And even before him, there was other attempts at making scripts. And it's interesting. You should read on Wikipedia their ideas for movies. Like, at one point, it was all about Magneto conquering New York, which is kind of cool. And there was going to be Sentinels and the Blob and Juggernaut and other things. And the Danger Room. Like, a lot, and they had to cut a lot of stuff. Because Fox, even though they were, I guess, enthusiastic about making this to a movie, they felt the risk strongly.
Mm.
So they cut the budget increasingly.
Right.
So it was only made for $75 million, which is obviously a lot of money, but, you know, in terms of huge blockbusters, I mean, today a Marvel movie probably needs at least $200 million to be made.
Hmm.
So sort of an abridged budget, shall we say. And, you know, so that was like the first hurdle against this movie, was that they had to do it on a tight budget.
Right.
Despite that, it seemed that there was a lot of, like, major Hollywood power behind this film. You know, Bryan Singer at the time, he was hot off The Usual Suspects. That was, like, his breakthrough movie. He made this crime mystery thriller.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a young sort of, I wouldn't say indie director, but a young, like, you know, intelligent director. And so he, I guess, is primarily responsible for setting the tone of this film, which I promise we're going to talk about. And I'd say the first thing I want to talk about is the casting. I think this movie is wonderfully cast, and it really set a precedent for the X-Men movies going forward. They really were able to land really interesting actors that that really carried the films in a really, you know, wonderful way. Like, more than anything, I think the stage presence of all these actors, like, really, like, makes the movies what they are.
I'll disagree slightly, but,
really?
But let's get into it.
Okay, well, let's talk about the casting.
Yeah.
So, mainly, you've got Patrick Stewart as Professor X.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a home run of casting.
Yeah, I agree.
Famous, bald, science fiction guy from Star Trek.
Yeah.
With gravitas, English acting. You know, of course, Professor X is almost, that's almost Professor X to a T,
yeah,
in a sense.
Yeah, that fits really well for me, too.
Right, yeah. Okay, so that.
And then Ian McKellen.
Right, as Magneto.
Again, for me, like, that's a home run of a casting decision,
yeah.
You know, and I think,
a little,
like,
old, but still interesting, an interesting choice for a movie like this.
Right, but also, there's definite, like, chemistry between the two them, right?
Yeah.
So this, like, sets a precedence for
Their wonderful, cute Twitter interactions they've had for years and friendship that we've seen between Ian McKellen and Patrick Stewart. They became, like, besties.
Right, that too.
Yeah.
In real life, it's nice that it, like, bleeds over like that, but I think, like, going forward, mm-hmm. when we get into, like, other X-Men movies
right.
in the future, like, the friendship between those two is, like, one of the most, like, humanizing relationships that
yeah.
are, like, that's continually built through the X-Men movie universe. And I think it starts with these two actors.
Yes,
it's like,
definitely.
You see their, like, chemistry on screen, and, like real emotion is
yeah.
built with it, and, like, there's a lot of history, and just, like,
great acting.
And great acting.
Yeah.
And I think, like, that's so successful that, like, they can't leave that out of future movies, even if it's not, like, the major plot point.
Yeah. I mean, you could argue that as we get to the very end of the series with X-Men Apocalypse or Deadpool, well, I mean, we're not talking about Deadpool right now, but with, let's say, X-Men Apocalypse, like, perhaps a little bit too much Magneto and Professor X. There's other relationships to
exactly.
explore. I mean, Magneto doesn't have to be, like, shoehorned into every plot.
Right, exactly.
You know, but it's a credit.
But I think, like, that's
yeah.
because of this setup
yeah,
with these two actors in this first film.
Right. It's incredibly powerfully strong bond, like, great hero, villain, antagonist. And not Magneto, not just a straight villain, sort of like a weird anti-hero, you know, or villain with, like,
a complex character.
Complex character, exactly.
Yeah.
Good way of putting it. All right, so those two home runs out the park. So, and then next, Wolverine, Hugh Jackman.
Mm-hmm.
So I read on Wikipedia, this is his Hollywood debut, essentially. He was an unknown actor.
Mm-hmm.
Bryan Singer wanted Russell Crowe to play Wolverine, and he
yeah.
turned it down. I don't know why, but he recommended Hugh Jackman, who was his friend from Australia.
Right.
And it has to be noted that there's just such a weird thing with Wolverine in Australia, because Wolverine, the character, is Canadian. But just like in the Pride of the X-Men aborted animated show that got canceled, which we're going to talk about one day, I promise. They got, like, there was, like, an Australian Wolverine in there. He had this thick Australian accent.
Huh.
And Eric and Julia Leewald told us that was because Crocodile Dundee was really popular at the time, and they wanted an Australian Wolverine. But it's not just that. Like, Australian Wolverine also existed in, like, the Firestar and Spider-Man Iceman show.
Right.
When he would appear in that show, he'd also be Australian.
Weird.
So, yeah, it's just weird. There's something strange about Australians and Wolverine and the Wolverine-Australia-Canada triangle is quite like, is bizarrely intersecting.
I guess. I mean, Hugh Jackman makes an excellent Wolverine, and he really, like, grows with the character across the movies also. But I'll say that at the time that this movie came out, I was expecting a shorter, broader man to be Wolverine. He's like I thought it was kind of weird when I first saw this movie.
He's a tall, you know, like, athletic sort of much more handsome Wolverine, in a sense.
Yeah.
But that, despite that, his performance is amazing.
Yes, his performance is amazing.
Which justified Logan in the, you know, the recent movie, which was so great, you know, which everyone praised. The fact that he's able to take that character and carry it. I think, you know, so let's talk about Hugh Jackman a little bit. The first thing I was surprised in rewatching this morning was the fresh-facedness of him.
Yeah, he's really young in this movie.
Yeah, I think he's in his early 30s, which is weird to think about. But, yeah, I mean, and now he's in his 50s, I guess, or maybe, like, he just turned 50 or something, late 40s at least. So, I mean, he did the role for 17 years.
Right.
So, but, yeah, so very fresh-faced, not quite as supremely muscular as he would get in the other movies. And that they said, I remember in the commentaries watching that years ago, they said that's because he was cast very late, like 3 weeks before the film started to shoot.
He was
cast as a last minute replacement, and he didn't get that much time to be in such great shape.
Right.
But then he'd make up for that in the future movies where he'd be shirtless a lot and be completely ripped.
Yeah.
In this movie, he just looks like a normal, like, in shape guy.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. But all right. But despite him being too tall and maybe a little too handsome, he gets everything else right. Like the voice is great.
The voice is great. Yeah.
The
tone
grunting
that he sets.
Yeah. Exactly. The tone he sets. The way his mannerisms. His acting is great.
Yeah.
The way he uses his cigar and drinks beer and his understated delivery. It's not the Wolverine from the show. And it's not the Wolverine necessarily from the comics. It's a more human take on Wolverine.
Right. Well, it's the updated version, but it's done well.
Yeah. And we'll talk about, like, why it's a little more different as we talk about the plot points.
Yeah.
But, Wolverine has to be great. He's essentially the star of the X-Men, you know. For better or worse, some people are kind of annoyed at Wolverine. He's overexposed. You know, it's kind of like, he's like the Batman of the Marvel Universe. They shoehorn him in everywhere, in a sense, but because he's so popular.
Yeah.
So Hugh Jackman, great, we have to say, right?
Okay, I'm with you so far.
All right, next. Famke Janssen as Jean Grey.
Yeah.
Surprisingly, more of a starring role in this film than I had remembered. She is, sort of like the lead actor of the regular X-Men.
Right.
And she gets a lot of moments.
This is one of my problems with this casting, though, is, like, I felt the same way. I hadn't watched this in, you know, a few to several years, and I didn't remember her getting that much screen time or having too much of a presence in this movie. And now rewatching it, she's actually on screen a lot, which means her presence is, like, not very strongly felt as a character. For all the screen time she gets, I feel like she should be more memorable, but she doesn't have a whole lot of dialogue that goes anywhere.
Yeah.
She doesn't use her powers for anything really consequential often.
We'll get into that as we go into the plot.
Okay. But
I disagree. I think she's great. I think, first of all, I think she's beautiful.
She is beautiful.
I like that she's not a young Jean Grey. She's like this mature woman in her mid to late 30s.
Uh-huh.
And that's kind of, that gives her like a confidence. And instead of like a sort of like a ditzy, like, naivete. How do you pronounce that? That pronounced that correctly, right?
Naivete,
right, yeah. I'm sorry. When you speak into a microphone, instead of just thinking thoughts in your brain, sometimes you realize you know how to say words. So she's got confidence. She's got a seeming sense of experience. And as we mentioned in a previous episode of podcast, she's a doctor in this movie.
Right.
They made her a doctor. And our theory was that it was to make up for the lack of Beast in this movie, at least this first movie, that they need a doctor on the team. I don't know if it's established that she's a doctor in the comics. I don't really think so. Maybe at some point later on. She's definitely not a doctor in the cartoon. So, but she's Dr. Jean Grey here, and it fits. I think that was like a very wise choice, because it reflects her intelligence. It always made sense to me too, because you would think that someone who is a telepath would be like a super genius as well.
Yeah, I guess so. But, like, again, you don't really see her use telepathy too much.
Not too much, yeah.
I think, like, most of the reason that she gets screen time in this movie is because she's Logan's love interest.
Right, they set her up as the...
Centered around Logan.
Right, that's true. Okay, but we'll get into that. But I other than that, though, I think she looks great.
Mm-hmm.
I love the way they costume her. She's often in, like, these red power suits or, like, beautiful red tight dresses, and it's very sexy to me. And, you know, surprisingly, her hair is not as red as I thought it was going to be in this first one.
Yeah.
I think they dye it really red in the next two.
Uh-huh.
Maybe not in the second one. I'll have to see.
Part of the... Well, I guess we'll talk about the outfits and stuff later, but, like, I think it's part of, like, the toning down to make it a little more palatable for people who are not comic book
But there is something... Nerds. It's something coolly comic booky about that she wears, like, bright red.
Yeah.
You know, it's like there's something that stands out about it. It's such a bold choice.
I'll just say that everything you just mentioned that you like about her has nothing to do with, like, plot points, her actual personality, or, like, her...
Well, I'm just talking about my first impressions. Okay, but Famke Janssen, I do think she's a really good actress.
Uh-huh.
I think she's great in this role. She's got a real understated confident presence.
Okay.
I'm just sold by her, so I'm a little more impressed with her than you are.
All right.
I think her, like, not being as, like, forward as you're suggesting, I think that has a lot to do with the movie in general, the tone of the movie, which is very understated and quiet.
Okay.
So, all right, but let's move on. James Marsden as Cyclops.
Mm-hmm.
Now, unfortunately, in this movie, and unfortunately for the entire series, the character of Cyclops is really pushed to the background, to the edges of the movie, which really upset a lot of fans, including myself. You know, Cyclops is central to the X-Men story. He's central to sort of the character... like how all the characters fit in with each other, and just like by making him a side character, it diminishes the source material in a way that's not like it's not like such a sin, but it did rankle me a bit.
Right. Well, he's the leader.
Yeah.
Right. Like he's one of the leaders.
He's the field leader.
But on the other hand, that's not the story that they're telling in this movie.
Right.
So. Yeah.
So right, and in this movie, it's kind of like the X-Men are sort of pre-established and. They're all grown up.
Yeah.
So it's not about the story of how they're formed. You're just sort of like picking up in the middle somewhere.
Right.
But I think James Marsden is sort of... I think he's an excellent actor, first of all. Everything I've ever seen him in, I've enjoyed. And we've had this argument. I think he's like the poor man's Tom Cruise.
I think so.
Like he's the guy Hollywood casts when they want Tom Cruise, but he's too expensive or unavailable.
No, I don't think so. I think James Marsden is younger than Tom Cruise,
right.
So he like fits a slightly different demographic. He's also much taller, and like so I think like his physical presence is different.
He's likely less crazy than Tom Cruise in real life too.
Likely, but
yeah, so probably easier to work with. You know what I mean? And
but I'll agree with you. I think James Marsden was a good choice for this casting.
Yeah. And I think with the very little they give him, he's excellent. He really captures a realistic Cyclops.
Yeah.
It's not a cartoony Cyclops. It's a very like steady, self-assured, just interesting guy that unfortunately just doesn't get that much opportunity to shine.
Mm-hmm.
But really, they hint at a greater character there. To mention really quickly, that's what this movie is primarily most successful at, in my opinion, is that they hint at bigger things without, like, ruining stuff by, like completing it. You know what I mean? They don't.
Yeah.
They leave everything open-ended.
Mm-hmm.
They don't just say, like, here's Magneto, and that's all there is to him, and, you know, there's no subtlety at all. It's like, and then now he's dead or something. You know what I mean? Like, sort of like in the first Batman movie, they kill the Joker at the end. You know what I mean?
Right.
They show who the Joker is, where he came from, his origin, how he became Joker, then he dies, and that's the end of the Joker.
Right.
You know? It's like here, everything is thankfully left open-ended in a continuum, you know, for the most part. So,
yeah.
And Cyclops is reflective of that. Okay. Next, in a major casting, Halle Berry as Storm.
Yeah. Well,
I just gotta say, like I said, Angela Bassett was considered even for this late '90s version, and they also talked to Janet Jackson apparently, which would have been interesting.
That would have been interesting,
right? But Halle Berry, an excellent actress.
Yeah,
I mean she's an Oscar winner,
right?
Been
in
huge franchises and other.
Yeah, I feel like she really takes a lot of criticism for this particular role, and I understand why. I don't know.
It's the part.
Yeah.
I think it's a combination of a few things.
Yeah.
The part is underwritten.
Mm-hmm.
The tone of the movie is very subtle and very quiet.
Yeah.
Storm, the character, is, at least from, you know, what we know her from the comic and the cartoon, she's very loud in a good way.
Right.
You know, like,
well, that's the most disappointing thing about this part. It's not Halle Berry's fault. Same as, like, with what we were just saying with Famke Janssen.
Right.
My like grief about it is not so much like the acting itself; it's the way the part is written, and does the casting like lend itself to something bigger than the way the part is written? I guess right.
Yeah.
So like with Halle Berry, again, like her physical presence is not like quite what I expected. Mm-hmm. Right. Like Storm is supposed to be like pretty tall and like. She is a physical presence, you know.
But Storm also extremely beautiful, and so is Halle Berry.
That's
among
true.
Among the most beautiful people of all time.
Right, yeah, yeah, definitely.
So
but
that
I'm,
works.
Like, really, really missing those scenes that you see in the cartoon and the comic book where it's, like, when she's summoning her thunder or whatever.
And talking to Mother Nature.
Yeah, exactly. Like, she's really got to, like, yell at the universe. And, like, Halle Berry doesn't do any of
it
that.
Doesn't...
She goes quiet and she concentrates and, like, her eyes cloud over and then the storm comes and that's it.
Yeah, that's right, and you're right. It's just it's not as fun and as big as it should be.
Right.
But you know, also let you know, and they put her in the leather X-Men outfit, and also kind of like Jean Grey though in her regular clothes, she wears like the bright white colors that is reflective of what her costume would be like in the comics.
Right.
Which is something you know we'll get into more, but right. So it's kind of like it's a misfire and it's a shame, and they kept. You know, to their credit, they kept bringing her back for subsequent sequels, and she kept coming back to play Storm.
Right,
it's
that's
not like
true.
She was so bad that like it was like unpleasant to see her.
No, I mean she gets a lot of like flack for the accent thing or whatever. But to me, it's not even about the accent.
Yeah,
it's like
because it's so quiet anyway. It's almost like you can't hear the accent.
Right. It's just like same thing as with Jean Grey. I feel like she doesn't have enough dialogue, and the dialogue she has is not forceful enough.
Right.
So like the character doesn't really get a chance.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, she gets a lot of flack for the wig they put her in this movie.
Right,
and
which, again, not
they
her fault.
Right, and they keep changing the hairstyles from movie to movie, and, you know, that's something, I don't know. Not her fault, you're right. I don't know, it's just, it's like a missed opportunity, because Storm is a great character.
Yeah.
And really, up to this point, she hasn't been shown well on the big screen. I love the new actress they got for X-Men Apocalypse. I think her name is Alexandra Shipp.
Mm-hmm.
She's another sort of like a beautiful young actress, but maybe again a little too puny for Storm. She's like just a little, not like a little girl I was going to say, but just like a small woman.
Right.
And but you know, she has a chance to grow into the role as well. She's coming back for the next X-Men movie.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully they do more with that character, hopefully. But yeah, I mean, they just haven't quite gotten Storm right yet.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, well, I don't know. We were supposed to be talking about casting. I guess most of my grievances now that I'm talking about it are more with, like, the character writing than the casting itself. But I feel like the casting could have influenced, like, the presence of those characters.
Right. Yeah, that's true.
Way.
All right, and let's quickly go through the rest of the cast.
Well, you're missing one other, like, main character there.
Oh, Rogue.
Rogue,
Anna Paquin. Right. You have a lot of problems with Anna Paquin as Rogue, don't you?
I do. Yeah. I think, well, I mean, this probably has been discussed to death, but, like, the age difference is, like, strange to me that she's a generation younger than the rest of the X-Men.
All right, well, let's just say that in this movie they take liberties in playing around with what's been established in the comic books.
Yes.
And the cartoon to a lesser extent. They move characters around in age. You know, they drop characters in and out to their own narrative needs. You know, for instance, Iceman is a young guy. He's
right.
not in the comics, he's an original character.
Right.
So that's something that's different. And Rogue in this movie is an amalgam of other X-Men characters that have served her narrative purpose, mainly Kitty Pryde and Jubilee.
Right.
So, which weirdly appear in the movie as cameos.
Right, but they're the same age as Rogue.
Yeah.
Which, to me, like, just doesn't fit. Like, why do you need to, like, age Rogue down to tell that story when you have Kitty Pryde or Jubilee?
I read that Bryan Singer, it said on the Wikipedia page that she can't touch people and absorbs their powers, that he thought that perfectly represented mutant alienation.
Okay.
So that was, like, a good reason to, like, have her in that role.
Yeah.
But I think secretly everyone who's an X-Men fan prefers Kitty Pryde in that archetype. And the archetype is the Wolverine sort of semi-adopts a young mutant girl, like a teenage girl, mm-hmm. and brings her into the X-Men. And yeah. the first is Kitty Pryde, and then it's Jubilee.
Right.
And in this movie, they make it Rogue. And it's a letdown.
To me, it is a letdown, yeah. because to me, like, Rogue is a really fun, strong
yeah.
character. She has, like, a lot to say, and she says it, like, confidently.
Right.
And, like, there's a lot of really great things about, like, adult Rogue that are sorely missed in this movie, I
yeah.
think.
Yes.
So,
a lot of complexity for the Rogue we love from the cartoon that it's cartoonish in a way, but, like, surprisingly complex
yeah.
for that kind of character with such a big accent and such a larger-than-life personality and stuff. Mm-hmm. So you're right. It's kind of like it's really the filtering of Rogue into, like, this, you know, scared little teenage girl that is mousy and quiet.
Right. So, I mean, all of that, again, has been characterization and not casting so much. I mean, I don't know. I don't want to be, like, totally down on Anna Paquin. Mm-hmm. I'm sure she's, like, following direction and
yeah.
whatever. But I just find, like, her acting is a little overdone in all of those qualities that you just listed. Like,
I agree. It's not my favorite performance. And I think I don't think it's Anna Paquin's fault, personally. I think it's the script. I think it's the way the character is written. I think, you know, I don't think Anna Paquin would ever be the actress to play the Rogue we enjoy. You would have to get some other type of actress. She couldn't play the flying, super strong Rogue that's really, like, confident and witty.
Mm-hmm.
She, you know, that's just not who she is as an actress. So, again, not really her fault. I know you don't like Anna Paquin sort of aesthetically, in a way.
No, it's I don't know. It's not that. Again, it's just, like, the acting. Like, I feel like the all of her facial expressions, like, really convey this, I don't know, like, the awkward teenage experience.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, maybe that's an excellent casting choice. But if, like, you know, that's what they're going for, you know, they're trying to show all of these awkward teenage moments, and that's fine.
Yeah.
But, like, there's just too much of that.
Okay.
In this movie for me.
All right, so that's essentially the main cast, though, right?
Uh-huh.
All right, cool. So let's dive into the movie. So the movie begins with this interesting sort of prologue from Patrick Stewart / Professor X, where he's talking about, you know, what mutation is, that human beings evolve, and that we're on the next precipice of evolution in terms mm-hmm. of humanity. And then we dive into a Kubrick-esque, you know, rabbit hole of genetic, like, CGI nonsense of, like, glowing, you know...
The birth of this genre.
Right, the birth of this genre, the rebirth of this genre.
Yeah.
And then we get to the X-Men logo, which I'm actually, looking back on it, kind of disappointed in. It's just, like, a flat logo in black that says X-Men, and it's just... use the logo from the comics. It's kind of iconic, that bolded out... studded logo that's mm-hmm. usually in blue and yellow. You know, it doesn't have to be blue and yellow. You know, I think in the cartoon it's not blue and yellow. It's something. It's like some other color scheme, but it's the same style.
Mm-hmm.
It's like that's the iconic X-Men branding. You know, I get disappointed when these movies ignore easy branding that are really ways to wink to fans that doesn't have anything to do with the movie. You could have
right.
the X-Men logo and have it not, like, impact your movie in any way.
Well, but again, they're trying it out, right?
Yeah.
Like, because it's the first one mm-hmm. and they don't know how many comic book fans are really out
right.
there versus, like, are we going to be able to draw in some general public that
yeah.
are not comic book fans? Better err on the side of less comic-y.
But isn't that weird how how creatively, when they're making these choices,
yeah.
that must have come up when they're like, all right, here's the title card with the logo of the movie. That's also going to appear in the posters and the marketing, whatever.
Yeah.
It's just kind of strange. It's like, you know, a movie is a fantastical thing. It's a thing of imagination, right?
Right.
And it's like, here's your chance for the movie poster. And just stamp the comic movie thing, the comic book icon on your movie posters. It's like, to me, that's like a real magical moment, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's really magical for the fans. I don't know. And like I said, this is a very small gripe, but I just find that...
Well, but it's like, it bleeds into other things too, right? Like,
yeah.
I think there's this overall aesthetic in this movie of, like, it's the year 2000 and
yeah.
we're modern.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah. It's the future. And this movie takes place in the, quote, not too distant future, which is interesting.
Right. So it's not just the logo, but it's also, like, the costumes, like you were saying, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Everything's pared down in this way that they're trying to like, they're definitely aiming for tastefulness.
Right.
But with
is it successful as like tastefulness? I don't know.
What do you mean by that?
Like, do you feel like it's actually more tasteful for all that, like, downtoning?
I think at the time, it was very well done. I think the tastefulness was very appropriate. Mm-hmm. That's the funny thing about this movie. In retrospect, it could have been bolder. So, like, all those types of criticisms, like I'm seeing with the logo, what I'm about to say about the music.
Yeah.
I like the score of this movie. I guess it was composed by Michael Kamen.
Uh-huh.
Interestingly, I read on Wikipedia, too, they wanted John Williams to do the score, and he almost said yes, but couldn't because of scheduling.
Uh-huh.
And that would have been cool, because
yeah. You've
got the Richard Donner connection, and it's the rebirth of the franchise, and the great John Williams would be doing the score.
Right.
But anyway, this guy, Michael Kamen, does it, and it's fine. I think it's pretty catchy and good.
Yeah.
But it's like, to me, also, you've got this iconic television score that this is where people who know about the X-Men for the most part know it from the cartoon. I mean, obviously you know it from the comic book too, but the cartoon was the first thing that brought to life with music,
mm-hmm.
and you've got this like killer, super catchy electric guitar riff orchestral thing already in the bullpen.
Right, so if you want to modernize it, fine, but like...
But use it, though. Use that melody. I mean, I think that would just... That would make people... I guess it would have probably been seen as too corny at the time, because by then the cartoon had already flamed out, and it flamed out in a not great way, as we'll mm-hmm. get to by the time we get to season 5.
Yeah.
But, you know, so maybe by that point, it's not like the cartoon had any sort of nostalgic, juice to it. It was, it was already sort of old hat.
Yeah.
So they probably didn't want to get away from the cartoon as much as possible.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, like, in my mind, if I was... I still think that would have been great to incorporate the score, the iconic score.
Yeah.
And that I've said that on a previous podcast. I have that problem with a lot of these movies. You know, John Williams composed the Superman score. It's genius.
Mm-hmm.
Just use it forever from that point out. That's all you need to use. It's the music that announces Superman that everyone associates him with. It's almost a letdown when it's not used.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing with the Danny Elfman Batman score that was then used amazingly in the Batman animated series. Again, like, why... You know, why switch scores? These are characters that never stop appearing, obviously. You know, they're never going to stop making these characters. So if you've got music that goes along with it, I just think that's like a nice, like, artistic, creative thing to do, especially when you hit on gold like that. And so I would say this, I really do believe in my heart that the X-Men animated series score belongs in that category as well. And the X-Men are weird enough that they could use a cartoon score,
mm-hmm.
in my opinion. It's not like some grand epic thing. It's fun.
Yeah.
So,
well, but that's what I'm saying, you know, it's the year 2000, it's time for grand epic things.
And it's time for, like, newness.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, I mean, now we're at a point where maybe they could bring it back again, you know.
It's like I would. Years, I don't think they're going to.
No, I don't think they're going to,
they're
but I'm saying
to.
It's, like, years later and, like, things like Guardians of the Galaxy have taken off and, like, it's, like, I feel like things are relaxing a little bit again.
The time for outrageousness is here.
That's right.
With this stuff, right? You know, it's, like, and that's something I'm going to talk about a lot with this movie in general, is that it's the boldness is so pared down, and even, while in one sense it's good,
mm-hmm.
for a movie like this, in another sense, the X-Men is all about boldness and bigness.
Yeah.
So that's sort of like something that the movies are always fighting with in a way.
Right.
Like pairing realism with like the bigness of the science fiction incredibleness of the X-Men.
Right.
Sorry,
we haven't even gotten...
No, that's okay. This is an awesome conversation.
I'm
surprised we've gotten this far. So the movie opens. That's a score. The movie opens. So right away, Bryan Singer makes this like crazy-ass... Talking about boldness, this is a bold choice.
Yeah.
He opens the movie in a concentration camp in Poland in 1944. Jews are being marched into a camp. Some are going in one line, and some are going in another. We all know what that means. One line is to instant death. Well, not instant, to excruciating, horrible death. And the other to slave labor. And it's at this point, a young boy is separated from his parents. It's pouring rain. There's Nazi soldiers. It's so fucking tragic. I mean, it's literally, it's as aesthetically close to Schindler's List as you can get, almost, without it being in black and white.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
it almost, it's like a little sepia toned.
Right.
So
yeah, it is.
So
yeah.
The colors are turned way down.
Right.
But anyway.
So anyway, the young boy is Magneto. His parents are being led away. I'm guessing they're being led to be killed. And he consents what's going on, you know, and he reaches out with his hand and to try to he's like, you know, his emotionality, he's like reaching with them with his emotion, and he ends up tearing the metal gate that separates his parents from the rest of the prison camp, and the Nazi soldiers have to like smash him with a gun to knock him out, and it's quite the scene that establishes Magneto, and mm-hmm. it really colors in the background of his character in a wonderfully rich way.
But succinct at the same time.
Yes,
you know, it's not
very
a long
succinct,
scene,
yeah.
But like you get what's going on with him.
Right. So, I mean, this is the most striking thing about the movie, I think, overall. And it blew me away when I was 16 years old watching this in the theater with my friends. Like, I was like, yeah! Like, you know, and I'm not, obviously, not saying, like, to say the Holocaust is something for our entertainment or anything. I happen to be Jewish, but so I can maybe I get a little bit more leeway in talking about this. But I was just saying, yeah, the gritty, realistic tone of the X-Men. Oh,
yeah.
My God. This isn't like Batman and Robin.
Right.
You know, this isn't some silly, jaunty affair. This is like the real world.
So now aren't you glad that they changed the X-Men logo?
No, the
gritty realism.
I don't think those things. I think that's the magic of the X-Men, though. It's like it's a combination of realism with craziness.
I'm just saying, because of that kind of choice, right?
Mm-hmm.
We're going to open with a Holocaust scene.
Yeah.
I can understand why they're not going to use
the X-Men logo with lightning bolts going through them, like we see in the cartoon, the big score.
Right. You know what I mean?
I would think, though, I see what you're saying. I think Quentin Tarantino would do what I'm saying.
Yes.
He would have no problem melding in the cartoony with the realism
right.
in a really like abstract like pop art way.
But I think you're right,
yeah.
But I think like Quentin Tarantino like makes really unique pieces of artwork that like not every director is prepared to make, you know.
Absolutely. So yeah, I know. That's like a high you can't I think more people should aspire to that his level of artistic genius in the sense of being like making these bold choices.
Okay.
You know, people are there is a sense, I mean, his movies, when you see a Quentin Tarantino movie, you do not see the hands of studio concern imprinted on them with in terms of tone and tastefulness. He just does whatever he wants,
right.
And you just have to take it or leave it. You know, movies like this, you see the focus groups, you see the studio executives, you see the collaboration,
mm-hmm.
which is not, you know, not everyone can be Quentin Tarantino, so
no.
You can't just...
You gotta let Bryan Singer be Bryan Singer.
Right, yeah. And, you know, and I think this was his attempt at, like, being pretty bold and outrageous to, you know, insert a scene from the Holocaust in his silly comic book movie, you know, in the year 2000.
Yeah.
So, but I think narratively appropriate and off to a great start in that sense.
Right.
So that it's like I think it's a masterstroke actually
mm-hmm.
that they start there because it says so much about Magneto and it makes Ian McKellen's role that much deeper too.
I also really like the quick jumps like in sequence in the beginning of this movie that you start with
mm-hmm.
Professor Xavier's voice
right.
and then you get a quick scene of Magneto's origin story and then they jump right into a not too distant future with Rogue. It's like as an X-Men fan.
Yeah.
Like, you're getting little snippets, and it's, like, really exciting. The first time you're watching it, you're like, oh, I know all these people.
Yeah,
like,
yeah. So Rogue is in Meridian, Mississippi, in the not-too-distant future, as you mentioned. And it's pretty much the Rogue origin tale that we know. She, you know, in the cartoon, Rogue is walking along some sort of, like, moonlight bog in the deep south.
A riverbank,
and she makes out with her boyfriend, Cody, and, you know, Cody falls unconscious, and that's when Rogue sort of runs away. Well, after a confrontation with her father, who throws her out of the house because
mm-hmm.
he finds out she's a mutant. It's similar. She's with a boyfriend. She's talking about, like, she's already got the desire to explore the world. And she kisses the boyfriend for the first time. You see some weird Anna Paquin face acting right before she's about to kiss this guy. And then we get our first appearance of, like, the weird recurring theme of veininess.
Yeah, there's really a lot.
Yeah, so when Rogue uses her power in this movie, you see the guy's veins, like, become super present on his face.
They really, like,
deep
pop out
blue lines. Yeah, it's kind of gross. And there's, like, this weird sticky noise that goes along with it, too. So it's, like, appropriately gross in a way. You know,
mm-hmm.
her power is weird and strange. But the theme of veins will come up over and over in this movie, and we'll talk about them as we see them again. So that's just kind of strange detail. Anyway, Rogue is freaked out by this. Her parents come in. Her parents don't seem like so upset at Rogue. They're trying to help the boy. I guess we would assume there's a subsequent argument where they're surprised she's immune, or maybe she just runs away.
Mm-hmm.
Either way, she runs away, and we cut to northern Alberta, Canada, and she's riding in a truck with some truck driver, who turns out to be the immortal George Buzza, mm-hmm. the voice of Beast.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as I've mentioned many times, Bryan Singer, in preparation for this movie, watched every episode of the animated series in a row. And it's where he drew a lot of inspiration from. So I think him casting a guy from the show was a tribute to his love of the show.
Yeah, it's cute.
Yeah, it's cute. And, you know, he has like one line. She says, "I thought we were going to Laughlin City." He says, "This is Laughlin City."
Yeah.
And, you know, nice that Bryan Singer would put a guy from the animated series in the movie. That's a nice – he didn't have to do that.
Mm.
And then – okay, so here the narrative switches. We meet Hugh Jackman as Wolverine. He's fighting in a cage match with some guy, I guess, to earn money.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, we see him. He's tall. He's handsome. He's got the mutton chops.
Yep.
And the weird Wolverine haircut.
Yep.
They nailed that.
Yeah. He really has those hair wings out to the side.
He's really must be spending a lot of time in the mirror, you know, gelling it in that way. I guess maybe he just wakes up like that. But, you know, he's pretty hairy, which is good. You know, Wolverine is hairy at least.
Uh-huh.
And what's cool about this, it's like you actually get to see Wolverine's physicality in reality. That's what's so revelatory about this movie in general. Like that, you know, now it might be a bit old hat looking back, but this is the first like real serious Marvel movie, and it was always kind of stunning to see things you knew about the characters from the comics and the cartoon but come to life.
Right. So because you're always like, well, how are they going to do that? Like, here's how I imagined it in my brain,
right.
And like, how are they going to actually show it?
But when they do, it's great. Like, so Wolverine, he's got a metal skeleton or adamantium skeleton, as we know. So when he gets punched, or there's a scene where he blocks a guy's punch with his hand, and you just hear the clinking of metal,
yeah.
And the pain that the other guy feels. And then Wolverine, like, headbutts the guy, and you hear the metal clinking against this guy's, the fragile human skull. You know, and he's like Wolverine, sort of stretching his muscles around to unkink himself, and you hear his metal sort of body like clinking around in him, and you're like, oh wow, and you feel the weight of Wolverine's body too in that sense, that mm-hmm. this is a guy filled with horrible metal on all his bones.
Yeah.
So just that alone is such a great like magical realism detail that is brought to life instantly. You know, like they really, it shows that the filmmakers really sat down and thought about what are these characters like in real life. Because you can imagine them sort of like not thinking about his metal skeleton as like this thing that's like physically real existing, you know?
Well, I'll say like, I think it's a nice detail. It like, they have to kind of bring that to the forefront of your mind like mm-hmm. a few different times in this movie.
You're right, yeah.
Because it's such an integral plot point that he has a metal skeleton because...
Yeah.
That's how Magneto is able to so easily control him,
right?
So you have to know that.
That's true.
Yeah, because I've seen it a few times.
And in a sense, you're right. It becomes like they keep reminding us about it later on, which is whatever. But like I said, 16 years old in the movie theater for the first time, introduced to the character, you have no idea what to expect. This, too, I guess, was an unknown actor.
Mm.
So there's just something magical about like really like seeing the character brought to life.
Yeah.
And that's, a credit to Hugh Jackman, to his performance that... You know, is obviously so beloved.
Yeah.
So you know, he's in a steel cage. He gets into a fight, and then we cut to, you know, Rogue witnesses all this, and she can tell he's a mutant, and she's lost and has no idea where she is. And it's at this point we see more of Wolverine's power. The guy he fought in the cage match challenges him to another fight because he says, "You're a mutant. I know you are." Like, whispers in his ear, and Wolverine does not want to be reminded this, so he at this point pops out his claws. So that too is another stunning thing to behold in real life, and I thought it was done great. You know, so unlike the comics and the cartoon, where the impression is that the claws come out of the top of his hand, sort of behind the knuckles,
right? Like the bone that leads up to the knuckle is
right.
What sheathes the claws,
yeah,
is what I always thought, right?
Yeah. To me, it's the best way of talking about it. It's like the top of the hand, and in the movie, the blades are coming out of the the folded down under part of the knuckle.
Between his knuckles.
Yeah. I mean, everyone knows what we're talking about. They've all seen the movie.
Yeah.
And so that's different. And the blades are really... They're a little different. They're more blade-like in this.
They're wide.
Right. And I feel like in the cartoon and the comic, they're a bit more... I mean, at a time, it's drawn differently in the comics many times.
Yeah.
But traditionally, they're more like wiry, spindly claws, in a sense.
Uh-huh.
They sort of get sharper towards their tips, but the when they're fully extended, the part close to the hand is like almost like a metal tube sort of thing.
Yeah.
I mean, not quite. Everyone knows what I'm talking about. But, like, in this movie, they're big, fat blades.
They're knives.
Right. They're, like, long knives that come out of his hands.
Yeah.
And it's cool. You see the skin being pierced open in this, in like, a rectangular way, almost.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of really cool to see in...
Gross, but
cool.
Yeah.
And the sound they make. They got the sound perfectly. Mm-hmm. And some scenes, the claws look better than others because sometimes they have to use CGI, and sometimes it's a nice metal prop.
Yeah.
Or fake metal, whatever. So... And this scene's emblematic of that, because at one point they do look fake, another point they look real. So, but it's cool. He's got his claws. It's awesome.
Yeah.
And then, you know, he leaves the bar. Rogue sneaks away in the back of his truck. He discovers Rogue. And this leads to the best line in the movie, in my opinion. The best line of dialogue.
Oh, yeah. When she asks him, like, oh, when they come out, does it hurt?
And he says, every time.
After a dramatic pause.
Yeah, after a beautiful beat. Yeah.
Yeah.
Every time. And that is just, oh, that, like, that, in a way, sets the movies apart from the source material. You know, you
like that gritty realism.
Yeah, and you no, but it opens up. It just says so much about his character.
Yeah,
it speaks that like he's had to use them obviously a lot in situations he regrets, and that whenever he has to use them, it hurts. You know, like his coolest powers is a pain to him.
Yeah,
like a deep physical pain. And it's just like it's such a great characterization and such a
it just
efficient
makes him, like,
piece of dialogue.
So much more infinitely tough even than he was before.
Yeah, absolutely. And just so much of, like we said before, Hugh Jackman's great. He's always smoking a cigar, which is what the Wolverine character does in the comic books. We obviously can't see him do that in the cartoon. You know, they don't want to show a character smoking.
Yeah.
But here he is smoking. He's drinking a lot. They get into a cute argument about their names. You know, he's like, what kind of name is Rogue? And what kind of name is Wolverine? Okay, checkmate.
Yeah.
And then, you know, da-da, Sabretooth smashes the car. Wolverine goes flying out of it. We don't see Sabretooth right away. And then we see Wolverine's healing factor, which is another great introduction of powers in the movie.
Yeah.
So, like, the introduction of powers is, at least for Wolverine, is sort of a wonder to behold. So he's completely fucked up from this car accident. He went flying 50 feet. His skull is mangled to the point where you can see his skull, his metal skull behind his skin. It's like torn open, his forehead, I mean.
Mm-hmm.
So you see that. You see it heal. It heals fast.
Right, like as he's talking to Rogue.
Right.
Like, are you okay? She's like watching his wounds heal up on their own.
Right.
You also see him use his...
Smelling
powers.
Yeah, he's got smelling power, which is good.
Right.
And he smells Sabretooth.
Yeah.
You know, this version of Wolverine doesn't have his memory, so he doesn't know who Sabretooth is. It's a bit confusing as to why Sabretooth doesn't recognize him.
Well, we don't know that Sabretooth doesn't recognize him.
We don't.
Sabretooth is, like, classically silent.
Right.
In this scene.
Well, because they hired, like, a wrestler to play him. They didn't hire a real actor.
Right, fine. But I'm just saying, like, we don't know definitively that Sabretooth doesn't recognize him.
That's
true. He
just
doesn't say anything.
Well,
to
he
him.
Steals Wolverine's dog tags.
Yeah.
And they never explain why he takes them.
Right.
But that's to hint, I think, at the past that they share together.
Mm-hmm.
That Sabretooth knows something. You know, I don't. Someone can address this in the Facebook group. I don't know if Sabretooth at times lost his memories as well with the experimentations. I know he was experimented on too.
Mm-hmm.
So they both have like a weird history of where their memories were wiped away, I think. So in this movie, it's just left more of a mystery. It's kind of a shame because Wolverine's backstory becomes such an integral part of this movie series in general,
mm-hmm.
that it's like they didn't think ahead to cast someone they really would want to use recurrently as Sabretooth.
Mm.
You know, they cast like this, you know, sort of like B-level wrestler guy because he's big and hulking. And I think he does a good job with this movie.
Yeah, I think so too.
Yeah, he doesn't have many lines like many characters, but his physicality is good and his action beats are really good.
Yeah.
And so, okay, so there's a fight. Sabretooth smashes Wolverine with a tree stump, and Wolverine goes flying and he's unconscious. And then magically out of nowhere, Cyclops and Storm appear.
Right. And which we talk about in the X-Men TAS episodes too. They always seem to know where danger is lurking, and they like show up at just the right moment to save everybody. Yeah. So it's, you know, like, is Professor X psychically finding like moments where mutants are in trouble?
That's the presumption that he's using Cerebro to track things that are of interest to him. You know, there's a scene earlier in the, you know, we actually jumped over a scene, I believe. We're introduced to Jean Grey. She's testifying before Congress.
Right.
She's wearing her red power suit. It looks really cool. And Senator Kelly is grilling her, saying that mutants are evil and they have to be controlled and arrested. And Jean's trying her best to defend herself. But people are in the Congress chamber are really clapping along to Senator Kelly's anti-mutant bigotry. Mm-hmm. And that's where we're introduced to Professor X and Magneto, and they have an interaction. We talked about it before. And their interaction's great, and Professor X is trying to read his mind. He says he's looking for hope, but perhaps he's actually trying to suss out what Magneto's plan is, and that's how the X-Men know what's going on in Canada.
Mm.
We don't really know, but
I didn't even think there's
enough of a thread there that we can presume that
right,
Professor X is onto Magneto's scheme. So anyway, we're introduced to Cyclops. We see him using his visor. His optic glass looked really good, I think.
Yeah,
I think they did a good job. I think it's about as well as that's going to look in a movie, and the effects don't change that much in subsequent movies.
Yeah.
It's pretty much the same red force. And Storm appears as well. She uses her wind powers. And they rescue Rogue and Wolverine, and I guess they knock Sabretooth out. Cyclops blows away Sabretooth. So and then they escape. I thought this was interesting. This is just a little nitpick. Somehow Wolverine is unconscious all the way back from the flight from Canada to New York to where he's on a hospital bed and they're treating him.
Mm-hmm.
It's by any indication in these movies, his healing factor is so fast that he would not be unconscious for that long, presumably.
Well, these are just things that happen in like superhero comics and shows and movies. It's like the powers are as powerful or as unpowerful as the situation calls for in terms of plot development.
Yeah,
so
absolutely.
I'm okay with that.
Yeah, it's fine. And so now this is our first interaction between Jean and Wolverine. And, Wolverine, he obviously had woken up in his coma, but he pretends to be unconscious, and he sort of grabs Jean Grey and chokes her.
Right. Well, it's funny. She, is, touching his arm.
Yeah, in a weirdly loving way.
Yeah, more loving than you would think for, a total stranger.
Yes.
And then she, starts to inject him with something, and that's the point that he chooses.
I think there's something about her powers that lend to, a broad sense of empathy. Mm. She can sense people's feelings and emotions, and she has a lot of compassion.
Right.
So I think, we could – it's one thing to just to blow that up to just romantic feelings, but I think she's connected to humanity in a grand way that makes her a force of compassion or something.
Hmm.
So you can interpret it as love, because in one sense it is,
mm-hmm.
but really it's like her magical connection to humanity that informs her compassionate behavior.
Interesting.
And then I think that's what makes Wolverine fall for her too, in a way, is because of her compassionate nature in that sense. There's something really attractive about that in a person who is just really open to just sort of accepting people for who they are and not being judgmental and seeing their beauty, and ugliness at the same time, whatever that might be. So I think there's a lot of that implied in Jean, and I think that's interesting.
Yeah, I think that's interesting too. Because I never really understood why Logan was so drawn to her. It's she's already attached to Cyclops.
Yeah.
So he knows she's unavailable. Is that part of the draw or what? I don't know.
This is something that's subtly implied in the comics too. Everything I just said, the something about her character.
Yeah, right.
That lends to a lot of compassion.
Yeah,
you
I
know?
Can see that.
And then, she's a beautiful woman too. So it's a combination of things.
Yeah. But I mean, so is Storm,
Yeah, absolutely.
And she's also a compassionate human that takes care of people and stuff.
Definitely. She's got the same sort of vibe as Jean Grey in this movie, in terms of her empathy and compassion too.
Right.
But I guess it has a lot to do with Jean touching people in a certain way, either I don't
yeah.
know. Like, maybe she, like, when she touches someone's arm to calm them down, she, like, psychically projects, like, feelings of calmness, and that, you know what I mean? Like, maybe she can't help it, or it's just the way she is, you know, or she's manipulative, who knows, but there's something about that character that's very, like, attractive and interesting, I think.
Yeah, okay.
Okay. So where were we? Some other details, just more broadly, I want to mention that we see the X-Men a lot in their normal clothes, and their normal clothes reflect the color schemes that they have as comic book characters.
Yeah, so it's like a nice gentle nod.
Right, yeah. So, for instance, Wolverine has his leather jacket with the yellow stripes on it.
Right.
And they're dirty yellow stripes. You can barely see the yellow, but they're there.
Yeah.
And that speaks to his sort of striped yellow, black and yellowness.
Right.
Rogue wears, like, a Red Riding Hood outfit, but it's green.
Right.
You know, so, okay, not quite as exciting. Jean is always wearing, like we said, red power suits or beautiful red clothing, but bright, dark, like, passionate red, you know, which reflects her Dark Phoenix, like, crazy side, or power side. Maybe crazy is not the right word, but her powerful side. Storm, always in, like, electric white costuming and her normal clothes to go along with her bright white hair. Cyclops, they don't really do too much. He's really just conservative. He's not, like, wearing blue and yellow outfits.
Right.
He's just usually wearing, like, a black turtleneck with some red accents, I guess. Any other characters? Professor X, we've seen a later scene. He's got a tie on with an X button in the middle of the tie.
Yeah.
Like a metallic X button. And that just made me wonder, like, what is the origin of the X-Men name in this movie? So, in the comics, it's clearly established they're called the X-Men because they have the quote-unquote X gene, and they also have, and this is pretty cheesy from, like, the first issue that Stanley and Jack Kirby wrote. They've got an extra power, so they're the X-Men.
Yeah.
So, it's, but you would really think that they're the X-Men because they're Xavier's men. They represent the Xavier philosophy. And that, like, almost makes more sense.
I think that's a little bit closer to how it's portrayed in this movie.
Yeah.
But they don't really discuss it.
They don't discuss it. I think... And in later movies, they talk about the origin of the name. And, I don't know, it's almost like a joke.
Yeah.
But in this movie, I would think it's just more about them being Xavier's men, not that they're X-Men with extra power or X-Gene.
Yeah.
So, you know, and that's just kind of funny to think that Xavier is, like, branding his school and all his team as the X-Men, and I don't know. It's just vain.
Why is that necessary?
Yeah, it's like a flash of vanity, or he...
It's team building,
but it's also, like, maybe... I mean, Professor X is legitimately the leader of the mutants around the world, in a sense. You know, the most famous, most progressive, smartest. So, but, you know, it's like, yeah, you would name them after him, but he's still alive and very active, so it's just kind of strange, you know.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's his character detail. That's most of them for now. I mean, and Magneto is, like, in, like, dark, like, purple.
Dark red, yeah.
Dark red, purple, and black, which is pretty appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so anyway, at this point we get the famous montage. Well, not quite yet. Well, Wolverine's, like, escaping from the medical bay in the bowels of the X-Mansion. We get to see the underground lair. It looks, like, pretty sci-fi, feature-y.
Mm-hmm.
It's a pretty good representation of what that might look like in real life, I guess. I was never that upset about it.
I actually, like... Spoiler for more movies that have come out since this one, but I actually enjoyed watching that scene again because it's a real callback to the movie where he's, like, in Stryker's like facility, you know, and it's like watching it just now, I was like, oh yeah, you could really see why he would be so freaked out because it looks similar.
He's been in a lot of, like, evil labs.
Yeah, right.
Right. Yeah, so you're right. That's actually a good beat there. And
Like, wasn't on purpose, because they hadn't even conceived of that next movie yet.
Right.
But whatever. Well, it fits well together now.
Let's segue into another major thing about this movie. So Wolverine's escaping, and before he escapes, he has to grab some clothes. He finds, like, a satchel and puts on an X-like sweater, an Xavier School sweater, but he sees the X-Men costumes displayed in glass cases.
Yeah.
And I thought this was a weird moment for two reasons. One, like, why are the... And you said this, actually, when we were watching it. You're like, why are these leather costumes displayed this way? It would seem hard for them to get.
Well, that's always what happens in superhero lairs, though. Batman has that same kind of setup where his costume, it's not on a mannequin or anything. Right. It's just, like, hung up in a display case.
Yeah, so you think it'd be easier if it was just folded in a drawer that you'd grab and or right. in your closet that you'd take out. But here it's in a weird plastic display case. It's set up very it's like after they're done using them, did they have to put them back and,
yeah,
like, hang
course.
Them up in, you know, in a way a movie set would hang up a costume?
Yeah.
So, okay, that's one thing. So that's weird. The other second thing is, like, they present them, like, he sees them. There's a moment in Wolverine's eyes where he's like, that's weird. These costumes, you know, what weird costumes. But the whole point of this movie is that they made the costumes less weird.
Yeah.
Like, that would make sense if he was looking at bright, garishly colored costumes, you know, the blue and yellow Cyclops costume or the bright silvery Storm costume with her, you know, bosoms and X symbols on them and things like that, you know what I mean? Like, the crazy outfits.
Uh-huh.
But here they're just regular black leather combat suits.
So, it's still weird. They're hanging up in display cases.
I know that's weird.
Because he's, like,
yeah.
trying to take in some clues because everything else is just these bright silver hallways and he's like, where am I? What
yeah.
is this?
Yeah, that's true. You're right. That's a legitimate point. But I'm saying that that moment, I think, would be even more interesting if they were, like, more fantastical. He'd be like, what is this place? You know, like, more, that would resonate more. I don't know. I'm just a little, you know, this is a big argument that goes back forever. The movie, there's always been a fight between the production people and comic book fans about what type of costumes to use. And so they settled on black leather costumes. I read that they said in the Wikipedia page, they said they thought it'd be good for them sneaking around at night too, that they're, you know, they have to be in the shadows. So in a sense, like,
I thought it just goes back to what we were saying before about
yeah.
like the logo and like all the
does.
Stuff that they're
yeah.
updating. So, I mean, whatever.
Yeah, I mean, it mainly does, but it's, to me, it speaks to this argument of, like, what, how do you balance the realism of the X-Men, the realism of the emotions that people love about the series versus the bigness of the science fictionness of it and the ridiculousness of it. It's a hard balancing trick to do. And I think people at this point are ready to have them be in the colorful costumes.
At this point, like right now? Or
yeah, right now
the
year 2000? They are. No, right. Not in the year 2000, but right now.
Uh-huh.
But it's like it's like we said, it's like the Quentin Tarantino thing. Do you just, like, throw out the craziness and just make people deal with it and still have your gritty, realistic tone, but people are in, like, weird costumes and you just have to accept it as the audience member? Or do you try to, like, reel the audience in slowly without scaring them away? Kind of thing. It's just, like, it's a tough question to answer. I personally, I think, I always, like, lean on the side of boldness. I want to make something as bold as possible while still keeping my realism. And to say, like, you know, all the emotions are real, the dialogue is sharp, you know, the situations are logical, but this is the costumes they wear.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's a famous line at the end of the movie where Cyclops is almost directly addressing this with the audience. It makes no sense in the context of his conversation. Wolverine's like, do you actually go out in these things? And he says, what would you prefer, yellow spandex? And it's like, that would, like, why would that be the alternative? It wouldn't, in reality. It's not like no one would think to put on yellow spandex. But he's talking to the audience who are expecting yellow spandex.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, and in that moment, we're meant to go along with Cyclops because that makes sense logically.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it is ridiculous to imagine that.
Yeah.
But it misses the point. I don't know. It's something that they haven't reconciled and figured out yet.
But that joke fits very well with the tone of the movie
yeah.
overall, right? Like,
yeah.
the tone of the movie is very, like, dry,
mm-hmm. yes.
understated jokes.
Almost like Ghostbusters.
Yeah.
In a weird way, because Ghostbusters is this place that starts in a very realistic place, well, outside of the presence of the librarian ghost.
Yeah.
But, like, they establish it's New York City, it's the real world, and here are these guys, they're, like, normal guys.
Mm-hmm.
And you see it through their experience, and the movie just slowly ropes you in with the more fantastical stuff. They have to, like, guide you along. First they get this bright white car, and then they have the proton packs, and then before you know it, you know, there's a dimensional portal opening up, and there's Gozer and a Marshmallow Man at the end. But because they laid it out in such a, like, intricate way, one brick at a time, you fully go along with the journey, and you accept it by the end.
Mm-hmm.
So you go from a place of total realism to wackiness. This is what this movie's trying to do, the same thing. It's like, although there's fantastical elements early on, they're leading you down this path of like semi-realism to more and more crazy stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I just think I think, like in Ghostbusters, they could have taken it a step further with bigness. They could have led us to an even more crazy place. And the promise of this movie is that by the end of it, they hint at sequels that promise, like, crazier stuff.
Mm-hmm.
That, like, oh, you've just seen the beginning. And that's fair.
Right.
But,
and they deliver on it later.
Not really.
To some extent.
Well,
not in terms of the style.
Right.
But, like, in terms of the events.
The events get bigger, but I don't think they capture the... They don't capture... This is what the X-Men is to me. It's all the emotional soap opera drama stuff rooted in real emotions and, like, the backdrop of, like, real social, cultural, like, bigotry and hatred conversations, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it's the bigness of, like, intensely larger-than-life science fiction concepts. Time travel, aliens in outer space, humongous monsters that are super large.
They show you all that stuff. Not in this movie, but in later movies.
They do, but they don't do it right. They keep holding back the reins in a way. It's not... I have this vision in my head of, like, in the Guardians of the Galaxy mold of the bigness of space monsters, bright colors, crazy stuff happening.
Mm-hmm.
The X-Men go to that place, too.
Yeah.
But
they keep it... Like color, the colors are toned down.
What
you're describing to me is really just like aesthetic, right?
It's
like,
not just aesthetic. It's a bigness of concept in terms of plotting.
Uh huh.
So okay, so let's talk about it. So for instance, in one of the movies, Days of Future Past, they face the Sentinels.
Yeah.
The Sentinels. Well, let me put it this way. The Sentinels are done right in the cartoon.
Mm-hmm.
They're enormous, the size of, like, skyscrapers. The X-Men have to fight them. They have to pit all their powers, and they have to slash them up. And the Sentinels are big, and they talk, and they're crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And it's fun. And in the movies, the Sentinels are kind of like, they're smaller. They're, like, just, you know, they're, like, 15 feet tall, maybe,
mm-hmm.
you know. And they don't talk. They are sort of, they're pared down in color. They're not... It's just not the same. It's not like the big moment that it should be. The same can be said about, let's say, Apocalypse in the X-Men Apocalypse movie.
Mm-hmm.
He's not as big as he should be.
Yeah,
he's not.
True.
He's not like he's Godzilla in the cartoons and in the comics. At times, he can grow that large. He can
right.
stomp around. You know, they show him grow in the movie, but only in like a mental like battle with Professor X.
Right.
It's just for the most part of the movie, he's just sort of like earthbound and walking around slowly and just weird.
Mm-hmm.
So it's things like that. It's like. Take it to the next level, like juice it up to like the insane sci-fi-ness.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the whole criticism people have with the X-Men 3, which is the Dark Phoenix movie,
mm-hmm.
where instead of Jean Grey gets her Dark Phoenix powers from like an alien force called the Phoenix Force, which is tied in with the Marvel comic cosmic fabric of the universe,
mm-hmm.
and it's tied in with the Shi'ar Empire, which is a spacefaring civilization from another galaxy,
yeah.
and with the Krulls and the Skrees and like all these like things,
crazy shit,
and it's like they're spaceships and they go to other dimensions. And they travel into the Emkron crystal, and the crazy crap. There's an Emperor Jaqen who's evil and space agents. I mean. That's taken all away from this movie. It's just they say it's the manifestation of her power.
Yeah.
And she's just her own, a force onto herself, and she's dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, that's not what it is. I mean, like,
yeah.
the X-Men's big. It's bigger
saying.
Than that, you know?
Right.
And I think fans are really waiting for that step into that world.
Hmm.
And the fun of X-Men, with the filmmakers here, and Bryan Singer, he gets half right. He gets the realistic part right. You have to ground the characters in the world of realism.
Hmm.
But once you've done that, once you've established that, take the chance just to go off on a flight of fancy into craziness. Now, will that work as a movie? No one knows yet, because it hasn't really been done.
Hmm.
And I think that's like something to be said about a lot of the superhero movies. They haven't quite gotten the total bigness of that the comics show just yet. I mean, Avengers comes close, but...
I mean, we keep referencing Guardians of the Galaxy because
yeah.
it's, like, a real break from, like, the tone of a lot
yeah.
of the other movies. For you, does it hit that mark of, like, it gets really crazy and big and colorful? And,
for
like,
Guardians of the
things?
Galaxy?
Yeah.
Almost. My only problem with it is it's an also-ran franchise.
Right.
No one really knew or cared about Guardians of the Galaxy. They're... like D-level characters, and Marvel, it's almost like Marvel did it as an exercise. Here's another property we control. Let's try to make something big out of it. And they
yeah.
did. They succeeded, and it's
right.
cool. But it's still, it's missing the sweet spot which only comes, and I hate to say it because people say, oh, who cares, like, which is more popular? The X-Men are and were popular. Those stories mean a lot more to people. And they're all tied into the greater Marvel universe in a way that's more important and interesting.
Right, but I'm saying, like, you're saying we need to test the waters at some point and see, like, if something really big and crazy can be successful. Yeah. I'm saying I think it has been done, and it has been the most successful. So it's been a slow build. You know what I mean? It's like first Bryan Singer's testing out, are people going to go for an X-Men movie? Yeah, they are. Okay, cool. And it's kind of a progression from there.
Yeah, and you're right.
And like they're not going to stop making these movies anytime soon. Right. Yeah. So
but and you're absolutely right though. Guardians of the Galaxy. The story is essentially X-Men in space.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, any team, Fantastic Four in space, you know, whatever team, Avengers in space. So it's the same, because it's a group of, like, weird, superpowered people. They're all different. They have to get along. And,
you know, heroes in space.
Right. So it can be done. I just think that the regretful thing is that you wish it was with the... You just wish it was with the properties you love the most. I don't know. And
I'm
I know that's like a minor point,
for the future,
I guess.
You know?
Yeah. Well, the next X-Men movie, X-Men Dark Phoenix, which is what it's called.
Yeah.
It's going to, they say there's going to be Shi'ar Empire, that, what's that redheaded actress? Chastain.
Jessica
Chastain. She's going to play Lilandra, you know, Empress Lilandra. And so we'll see. I mean, I still think that has a huge potential to be fucked up too, based on how they're doing it, but whatever.
Yeah.
All right,
we've digressed a lot again.
Well, that was a big discussion part of this movie. Okay. So, so where did we leave off? So Wolverine, he's being introduced to the school. He, you know, he has no idea where he is, but he's drawn into Professor X's room through his, like, mental shouting at him. And that's when Professor X explains the plot, like, who the mutants are, what the school is. And I thought there was, like, a funny beat here where, well, not funny, another moment where I'm going to nitpick. Wolverine is like laughing at all the characters. Mm-hmm. He's like, "You're Cyclops, you're Storm." It's like, "What does that make you, Wheels?" He's like, "This is the stupidest thing I ever heard." He's making fun of their code names, and it's like, "You've got a fucking code name already."
Yeah, calling the kettle black.
Yeah, your name is Logan, which we establish, and your name is also Wolverine.
And he's making fun of Professor X for being in a wheelchair.
Well, I mean, that's cool. Well, I don't know. I mean, that's okay. I mean, that's just like a weird, funny improv. You know, I don't think he's not insulting him that he's disabled.
Yeah, I know.
He's like imagining that's like that your power is somehow tied to your wheelchair, that you've got like an ultra powered chair that could fly. And that's fine. But anyway, I thought that was like a weird beat. And here's where the movie shifts tonally. Like, the movie really should have been about Rogue being the point perspective of all this weirdness.
And now it shifts over to Logan.
Yeah, so Rogue is also in the same boat as Logan when she's brought to the school too, but she's quickly adapts to the school. She's like shown in class right away, making friends, like learning how to be a mutant or whatever. And now it's all from like Wolverine's perspective. He's like, he's the only one still saying, "This is weird. I'm the normal guy. What's going on?" And what's weird about that too is that it's weird to have select Wolverine as our everyman.
Mm-hmm.
Because in reality, he's just as crazy as all the other characters.
Yeah.
He's, like, got his own dark, tortured past. He's got a triggered temper, you know, attitude. He's super weird and violent and scary. His history that I guess a lot of it, you know, in this movie he's forgotten at this point, which is part of the comic too, but his history is filled with insane adventures before he ever met the X-Men. He was a secret agent. He was experimented on. He's fought in World War II and World War I and the Civil War, like all this crazy shit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's got a life of experience. So to make him just like the calm everyman is a little... It's not like bad because Hugh Jackman does such a good job, but it's a little bit of like a weird misfire, I think, in the script. The script is like you can just feel the machinations of the script trying to make it normal or like straightforward,
mm-hmm.
and it's fine. You know, like I said, this movie is fine, but it's a little strange, and that speaks to the tone of the movie in general. Like we were talking about dry wit, a lot of the tone is so understated.
Yeah.
A lot of the actors are speaking in whispers most of the time, in very quiet tones. In one sense, that's good because it speaks to their confidence,
mm-hmm.
and their you know, the confidence they carry with themselves as people. They're not afraid or ashamed to be mutants.
But I think
they don't think
also,
it's weird. They're very self-possessed.
That's the thing. It makes it more normal. It grounds it more in reality because they talk kind of like how regular people talk. talk most of the time, right? So I think that's part of that choice with not having Storm, like, I summon you.
Yeah,
like,
and Wolverine people, being like, ah!
Right,
yeah,
like, people constantly. Don't really talk like that in real life, and they want to make these characters relatable as... Yeah. As like,
so that's a tough balance to strike, and I think you know, Bryan Singer establishes this tone that follows the series up to this day.
Uh-huh.
This like rounded tone of measured like speaking,
right?
Whatever it is of realistic speaking. And
I also like the notes that it hits in terms of the sense of humor of the movie, because it is understated.
Right. Humor's good.
It doesn't leave you with a lot of laugh out loud moments.
Right.
It doesn't have that bigness like you were saying.
Yeah.
But it does leave you with like a lot of moments where you're kind of like smirking a little bit.
It's clever.
Or like, you know,
yeah.
like
it's very
you're
clever.
Smiling to yourself a lot when you watch this
right.
movie.
Well, so let's just say, story by Tom DeSanto and Bryan Singer, script by David Hayter. Just throwing that out there. So,
yeah.
You know. But, you know, like we said, there's actually the script was rewritten like a million times by a million different people.
Right.
Joss Whedon at one point had a script, and some of his lines somehow managed to make it into this movie.
Yeah.
And we'll get into that. All right. So, and in these scenes, there's another montage of, like, what the school is like. We see Rogue in class, and the X-Men are the teachers. Storm's teaching history or something. Cyclops teaches, like, advanced physics. Like, who knows what he's teaching? Like,
yeah.
Motorcycle engines, jet propulsion or something funny. Jean Grey's a teacher. The Professor X teaches. So they're teachers.
Mm-hmm.
They've all graduated. They're not in school themselves. And that's kind of interesting and fun. That's always a fun detail, the X-Men, how the school operates. Unlike the cartoon, this school is filled with students. It's not just Jubilee.
Right.
and we meet Jubilee. Well, not we don't meet her.
No, we see her.
You
wouldn't know it's her unless know it's her.
And this is the first of many, like, Jubilee barely at the edge of these movies. They keep having her in a cameo in the background with no lines. This movie establishes that. In the very last movie, X-Men Apocalypse, Jubilee actually has some lines.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously different actresses all the way through.
Yeah.
And we also see Kitty Pryde. She's introduced a couple of times in these movies, too, as an extra before they make her a real character, played by Ellen Page.
Mm-hmm.
And also, just like the other characters, Jubilee in like her bright yellow outfit, Kitty Pryde in her sky blue outfit reflecting her character from the comics. That's kind of a nice touch.
Mm-hmm.
And these movies do a good job of, like, you obviously can't, like, focus on every character from the series and give them all their moment. So they throw some characters in the background, they change the ages around, they move the details around. And that's to be expected, I think, and fair in these type of movies, you know? You can't, like, make it all reflect the comics.
Mm.
And the cartoon does that as well. You know, they pick and choose where they want their cameos. And that's pretty interesting. And Iceman, Bobby Drake, they de-age him. They make him young, and they make him Rogue's love interest.
Right.
So, you know, I think the actor does a fine job, but I never liked the characterization of Iceman in all these movies.
Hmm.
He's too young and annoying, and I don't know. I don't know what his deal is. And they never, like, showed how fantastic his powers really are.
Right.
At some point, they finally give him, like, the ice slide, and he can ice his whole body. It just doesn't look right. I don't know. It's just Iceman, to me, is one of my favorite, most fantastical characters from the mm-hmm. comics, and he's just sort of underserved here. And I think you could make a whole movie about Iceman.
Yeah, definitely.
So, okay. All right, so we're introduced to the school. Wolverine is essentially the center of attention. Now the movie's more or less about him, kind of. Well, and also about Professor X and Magneto. Mystique is introduced. She kidnaps Senator Kelly in a helicopter. She pretends to be her friend Henry Gyrick, who turns out to be dead, Magneto reveals. Mm-hmm. He's a big character in the cartoon. He's part of the Sentinel program.
Yeah.
So a nice little throwaway reference. Mystique, Rebecca Romijn Stamos is Mystique.
We forgot about that casting decision.
In a torturously horrible production thing she's thrown into with how they had to apply that makeup.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm sure that was horrible.
Yeah, I read in the Wikipedia they said it was like hell for her, that what they had to do to paint that on her every day. And it's sad because she doesn't get many lines. She has like two lines in the whole movie.
Yeah, right.
And a lot of her performance is being other characters because she can shapeshift. So
right,
other people get to
it's
play
not
Mystique.
Her.
Yeah.
Yeah,
like Hugh Jackman gets to be Mystique. The Bobby Drake guy gets to be Mystique. You know, Senator Kelly gets to be Mystique. So, but she does a good job. Like, she inhabits that physicality very amazingly.
Yeah, I like that casting decision.
Much better. The role of Mystique, much more appropriate in these movies than with Jennifer Lawrence, where Mystique is, like, the star.
Right.
It makes no sense.
Right.
The one thing, I think, you know, the character looks cool. I think, you know, Rebecca Romijn Stamos is sexy and beautiful, but I don't get the choice of having her be naked.
What do you mean?
I just...
Oh, yeah, that's right.
She's nude.
She's always naked.
She's nude.
That's weird.
And it's, like, a choice she makes is, like, because she's such, like, believes in mutant, like, expression.
But in the comics and in the cartoon, she always has that white dress with
just
the
a dress.
Skulls.
And that makes... To me, it makes sense. Like, why wouldn't she be clothed?
Right. Nobody else is really naked.
It's weird that she's
even
a nudist.
Hank McCoy is not naked.
Right, yeah.
You know? If anyone has an excuse, it's him.
You're right, because maybe the hair could cover his genitals or something.
Or, like, how is he going to find clothes because his weird stature? But
yeah.
Anyway.
So I just think that, like, I don't know why she had to be naked. It's kind of and it's horrible for the actress, because if she had, like, a long white dress or something...
They wouldn't have had to paint her whole body
every
day.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, okay. It looks cool. It's iconic.
Yeah.
Of all the things, you know... The movies get criticism for not, like, presenting iconic imagery. Mm. Mystique is iconic imagery.
Yeah. That's true.
That's something that's carried along. I think that's, like, mainly why they even brought the character back in the reboots.
Right.
Because they just liked the way that character looked. It really works on screen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thus Avatar was born.
And so this movie, like, for all its, like, serious tone and trying to make it real as much as possible, it has, like, these flights of fancy cartoony moments.
Mm-hmm.
And here's, like, the first major one that sticks out. So Mystique kidnaps Senator Kelly. They go flying off to some totally isolated island. And it's, like, a CGI island in the middle of nowhere, just off the coast of America somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And it's Magneto's secret lair. And just that alone is pretty cartoony out of nowhere.
I liked it, though.
It's not bad.
Yeah.
I mean, but it's just, I don't know. He could be anywhere. He could be in the desert,
yeah.
You know, in Death Valley. You know, he doesn't... It's just strange that he has gotten a magical island in this gritty movie. You know, it's like an evil lair, very... Like, that's out of, like, the later Batman movies kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So weird touch there. We also meet Toad, played by Ray Park, who is Darth Maul in the Star Wars movies. He's just, like, a British, like, stunt actor.
Hmm.
And,
I didn't know that was Darth Maul.
Yeah.
Oh.
And he's also in heavy, gross makeup, and he's very slimy, and his powers... I don't know if in the comics he's got a long tongue. I don't think he does. I think he can just hop around in the comics.
Yeah, I don't remember.
His power
really.
Is just to, like, run around. I mean, not run around, jump around. Mm-hmm. Like, really, you know, amazingly.
Mm-hmm.
So, but in this movie, they establish that he's got this super long, like, tensile tongue... Kind of like Nightcrawler's tail or something that's, like, magically follows his instructions.
Mm-hmm.
He can also spit out venom and stuff, and he's really super dexterous and agile. So he's another sort of side character.
Yeah.
All right, so we see him in Magneto's base. They kidnap Sarah Kelly, and the main plot of this movie is that Magneto's created some kind of machine that can turn humans into mutants. And his plan is he tested on Senator Kelly first, and his plan is that there's some big, like, global conference of world leaders off Ellis Island, and he's going to go into the Statue of Liberty, put the machine there, and blast all the dignitaries of the world and all of New York City with radiation to turn them all mutants, and he thinks that's going to, like, flip the scales of mutant oppression in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Which is not, like, a terrible evil plot of his. That's actually kind of clever.
Yeah.
I like it.
Yeah.
It's a shame, you know, spoilers, it turns out his machine doesn't work. Sarah Kelly does get turned into a mutant, but he dies very quickly. And he gets turned into a really gross, like, water mutant. And like we saw with Rogue's weird vein powers, he gets a lot of weird veininess as well.
Right.
Yeah. So a lot of, like, weird, gross veininess going on in this movie. Sort of a strange, monstrous touch. What else do we got here? Oh, another point worth mentioning is Magneto refers to his group as the Brotherhood of Mutants. In the comics, they were the Brotherhood of Evil Mutants, which is, you know, that's a good fix.
Yeah, it's all a matter of perspective, isn't it?
Right, yeah. You wouldn't want to brand yourself as evil, I don't think. Magneto in this movie, a little more complex than he is in the early X-Men issues from the 60s. And then, you know, let's just keep playing along here, some stuff that stuck out to us. There's a scene where Jean's sort of putting Wolverine to bed, or just showing him where his bed is. He's going to live at the X-Mansion now. And she reveals to him that she can read minds, but she's nowhere near as powerful as the professor. And he's like, why don't you read my mind? And she does, and we get a glimpse of the Weapon X program, his dark and hidden past.
Right.
And then that leads into another moment where Cyclops and Wolverine express their mutual dislike of each other. That's like the purpose Cyclops serves in these movies is to be Wolverine's foil.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing more, which is kind of a shame. But they do it well.
Yeah. And I like it because even though they're, you know, they're not friendly, but, like, they have a jokey kind of relationship with each other.
They've got a working relationship where they just sort of casually tolerate each other.
Yeah.
So it's interesting. It's played fairly amusingly.
Yeah.
And then there's another scene where we see Rogue's power again. Wolverine's having a bad dream. I guess Jean Grey awoken Weapon X memories in his mind, so he's dreaming about Weapon X. And Rogue goes to try to comfort him in at night, and she's wearing a weird evening gown, right? And Wolverine stabs her in the middle of the night without realizing it. And one thing that stuck out to me about this, she should be bleeding a lot more than she is.
Really? Because what stuck out to me about this scene is that, like, it's not as scandalous as I think it should be, right? Like,
yeah.
A whole crowd gathers because after she gets stabbed, right. She, like, grabs onto his face and we see his weird veins pop out because she's stealing his power, his healing power, right. So that she doesn't, like, die.
Yeah.
And he feels super bad about it because he was dreaming and he didn't realize he was stabbing her and, like, right. It's a whole dramatic scene. This whole crowd gathers around them, students and teachers from the school because they hear the commotion.
Yeah.
And they're all just, like, staring. And it seems like the question on everyone's mind should be, like, why is this, like, older dude
with this 15-year-old
girl, like, in the middle of the night?
And her dress is torn.
Right.
And she's,
like,
stabbed.
Yeah, there's, I don't know. Whatever.
Yeah, right. It implies...
Maybe, like, they're just not going to touch on that because of the movie, but, you know, like...
Well, maybe Jean Grey can read everyone's mind right away and sense that what happened or... I mean, Professor X, too. They know that it's all an accident.
Yeah.
But you're right. That is, like, a very bizarrely staged scene. A young sort of, you know, girl in an evening dress. You're right. Like, an act of violence at night. And you're right. That speaks to a lot more than what it actually is. It's much more innocent. And then what else do we got here? It's at this point that Rogue... I mean, no, not Rogue. Mystique has infiltrated the X-Mansion as a student.
Mm-hmm.
I guess she learns about all these ins and outs of all these interpersonal dynamics.
Surprisingly quickly, but yes.
She disguises herself as Iceman, and she convinces Rogue to leave. It makes her really upset. Says, like, everyone hates you for stealing another mutant's powers. You never do that. You better leave now. And she, you know, she's emotionally fragile, and she buys it and leaves.
Yeah.
But this is another problem, like, why I think both of us dislike this characterization of Rogue. She's just not spunky, and she's just so fragile and weak and weepy and willowy. And
I also, like, rewatching this, I was like, that's a real leap that Mystique is taking, right? Because she's like, oh, the professor's like so upset with you or whatever. And it's like, how is she going to know, like, what conversations have and haven't been had with Rogue, right?
Well,
like,
I
maybe
guess,
Rogue has already spoken to the professor. It's like a half day later.
Right, yeah.
And, like, maybe the professor is, like, comforting to her. Like, maybe she's spoken to Logan or, like, a bunch of the other students and knows that everything's fine.
And,
like,
and how is Mystique not detected by the psychics at the mansion?
Yeah.
But also, I guess the presumption is that Mystique has infiltrated the mansion as a student and has been wandering around as a spy.
Right, I know. I just feel like she, like, takes some leaps and has more information than she should have, even if she had been, like, wandering around as a spy all morning.
Right. And then this, like, establishes more about Cerebro. Mystique also goes into the basement of the X-Mansion, and she adds, like, some sort of green goo to the Cerebro machine, which is weird that, like, the Cerebro machine is run on some kind of goo. Like, there's this there's good blue goo, and then there's bad green goo. So when she adds the green goo to it, when Professor X uses Cerebro later, he, like, passes out in a coma. So that sets that up. But that's strange X-Men science. We saw the green goo running Mr. Sinister's machines in our most recent
episode. Yeah, that's right.
There's this magical, like,
is it the same
fluids
goo?
Out there. Yeah.
We may never know.
We may never know. Well, let's see what else we got here. And then Wolverine goes after Rogue. He goes into the X-Garage, which is funny. We see all the different the fabulous cars the X-Men keep in their garage, just like in the cartoon and in the comics, too. And he steals Cyclops' motorcycle. And this is, like, another flight of fancy bullshit moment, like, of total cartoon nonsense. Like, why is this in the movie? On Cyclops' motorcycle, there's a button that he pushes, and it makes it go, like, 1,000 miles an hour. And somehow he can still steer it and control it, and he's really enjoying himself. But that was just so pointless and weird. I guess it's supposed to show that the X-Men are, like, have super technology, and that they're so more advanced than you would suspect.
Yeah.
But even still, it just doesn't It's just like a weird moment out of nowhere. So the X-Men, they're trying to find Rogue. She's escaping. She goes, I guess, into the local Westchester train station or something. Gets on a train. Wolverine finds her. He convinces her to come back. You know, he explains, like, you know, everything that you thought, you know, you're just, you were, you know, let's give everyone another chance. Like, something, you know, you interpreted it wrong. Which makes sense, you know. That's a nice little touching scene between them. But then Magneto comes on the train. He rips the train apart with his metal powers. He and Wolverine thinks Magneto's after him, but he's not.
Because Professor X thought that.
Yes, that's right. Yeah,
he was after him.
Right,
but
he's after Rogue. But it's just to, I'm bringing up the scene just to point out that Magneto holds Wolverine in the air with his metal skeleton, and he bends his claws in this really painful, terrible-looking way. But how would his claws bend back to normal?
I know. I always thought about that, too. It's like he gets his claws manipulated a lot, which I guess is just, like,
in the end of the movie, it happens
cool
again, too.
Effect.
Yeah.
But, yeah, then, like, the next time you see him, they're normal
you
again.
You would think that, like, once metal is bent, it's bent.
Yeah.
It doesn't, unless Magneto bends it back for him. At the end of the movie,
well,
too.
He's strong. Maybe he bends it back himself before he, like, sheathes them
he's
again.
He's not. I don't think, adamantium is supposed to be unbreakable. I don't think Wolverine can bend it with his hands.
What can I say?
Right, yeah, I don't know. Yeah. Who knows? So that's just something to point out. And then at this train station, we get our first fight between, well, not really our first fight, but first major fight between the Brotherhood of Mutants versus the X-Men. Sabretooth and Toad attack Cyclops and Storm. They rip off Cyclops' visors, and they show just what would happen without his visor, which is awesome. It's pure destruction.
Mm.
His beam destroys the ceiling. I don't know how many people died with the falling debris. They don't really show.
No.
But presumably many. And Storm, too, shoots a bolt of lightning at Sabretooth. Again, she's being choked, so she can't summon the lightning with her chance.
Yeah.
So, you know, another moment where Storm is kind of muted when she shouldn't be. But they show how powerful she is. And again, there's, like, this weird... There's always this weird thing. It's like, does Storm shoot lightning from her hands, or does she summon it from the sky?
No, she summons it from the sky.
I know she
they
does.
Show, like,
in
the
scene, she does, but I'm saying in general... Like, because sometimes in the cartoon and the comics, we see her shoot lightning out of her hands, like a lightning bolt.
See.
Other times, she has to use a lightning cloud.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, I don't know. That's always, like, I always wondered about that myself, what's going on with Storm's powers. Like, why did she need the hole in the ceiling that Cyclops created to summon the cloud to shoot Sabretooth? Can't she just use her hands to blast him? We don't know.
Well,
right?
Not in this universe.
Not in this universe. And, you know, forgive me if it feels like we're rushing a bit. This is a very long podcast. And we've all seen the movie, so we know what happens. Just pointing out stuff that stuck out to us. Another weird scene where Magneto's fighting the cops outside, and he shoots a bullet at a cop's head, and it's kind of like burrowing into his forehead.
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost the cop's making a noise like it's going in.
Yeah.
But and then at the end of the scene when he doesn't shoot the cop, the bullet falls out. There's no mark on his skull. And I thought that was weird. It's like,
but I also always wondered about that. Or, I don't know. Anyway, just now I was wondering about it. Because, like, the cop himself is not incapacitated. It's just that Magneto is controlling the bullet and Professor X is, like, stopping the bullet. Like, nobody's stopping the man himself from moving. Why doesn't he just, like,
back
his head up a little bit or, like, duck?
Yeah. And also, why doesn't... You know, and it's established that Magneto's helmet... blocks Professor X's telepathy, and Magneto says so himself to Professor X in the scene.
Yeah.
Why doesn't Professor X quickly have Sabretooth rip the helmet off his head?
Right.
And then, you know, that's a little plot hole. All right, anyway, whatever. Carrying on, Rogue is captured. The plot is that Magneto wants to transfer his power to Rogue so she can operate the machine because it'll kill him otherwise. The machine is that deadly.
Mm-hmm.
It exerts a lot of force on Magneto's life force, so he needs Rogue to do it, to make the sacrifice. We see in the background that Toad is building a replicant torch of the Statue of Liberty, and this is all off camera, kind of. So the plan is to replace the torch of the Statue of Liberty with the machine.
Yeah.
But I don't know what's going on. It all happens off camera, but, like, they have to have removed the torch in the first place. The torch
is
there.
Yeah, well, it's all metal. I thought it was just assumed that Magneto uses his power to, like,
take the torch
down and then put the other one up.
I guess, but no one noticed that, like, someone removing the torch floating off the Statue of Liberty and then being quickly replaced with another torch.
Eh.
I don't know. That stuck out to me, too, is a little strange, like, you know, A plus B equals, you know, Z29 or something. You know,
they explained it enough.
I guess, you're right.
Yeah.
So then Professor X tries using Cerebro, but because there's green goo, he gets knocked out, which is the X-Men tradition that Professor X is never around for the climactic battle, or he's always incapacitated or something. Because, of course, his powers would allow everyone to stop doing whatever they're doing.
What do you think of the representation of Cerebro in the movie, in this movie, versus like how it is in the show?
I think it's too dramatically overplayed.
Yeah.
I don't like that it's a single solitary room. Mm-hmm. I liked it better in the cartoon, in the comics, where it's just like in his office and it's a little helmet that comes down.
Yeah, I like that too.
It's a supercomputer that
it's
he uses casually.
Like the control room, right? And he has like computer screens and stuff around him at the same time that he uses it.
I don't get it, and I don't like that Jean can't control it. You know, like she has to use it, and she almost like gets in trouble herself.
Right.
Another funny scene where Professor X passes out from using Cerebro. They show like he passes out on the little platform.
Yeah.
But it's like, how are there no guardrails on that stupid? Like, he could have fallen off the side, fallen like, you know, like three stories or whatever, however big Cerebro is.
Right.
So that's a little funny. That's like almost like a self-aware joke about sci-fi movies, that there's a lot of open, big techno spaces, like the Death Star, where there's no safe handrails or guard, you know what I mean? You could just fall off a thin platform into nothingness. So that's kind of funny. So the X-Men assemble, so the plan is to, they fly in their awesome Blackbird jet, which is faithfully represented in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
The jet's invisible, it can't be detected by radar, it comes out of the bottom of the school, the students all see it fly away, it's kind of cool. They give Wolverine a costume, Cyclops is not happy that Wolverine's coming on the mission. They banter a bit about the costumes, as we discussed before. But it's cool. They're actually going on a real mission as the X-Men. And it's not like they're not the young kid X-Men. These are the adult experienced X-Men, you know, fully, like we said, self-possessed and confident, which is nice to see. They're operatives in action.
Mm-hmm.
They're smooth operators. And and they're very calm and collected. And they go to the Statue of Liberty. And the fight takes place in the Statue of Liberty gift shop, which is kind of silly. You know, in general, you know, or the museum shop, wherever that is. You know, there's like some funny moments. Wolverine goes through the metal detector, it goes off, and he gives Cyclops the finger with his claws, which is a funny moment. And Cyclops laughs at it, which is cool. It shows that they're like, they could have a relationship beyond just pettily hating each other.
Right.
And it is a weird scene. Mystique is disguised as a Statue of Liberty, like, dummy statue.
Yeah, why?
I don't know. But it shows how weird her powers are.
I have a lot of moments like that in this movie. Just like, why? Why is it like that? You know, like, why are they fighting in the gift shop? Do they have to go? I don't know.
They have to get to the crown or where the torch is to rescue Rogue.
Okay, so that's part of their climb up there.
Yeah, but it's a criticism that goes back to when the movie was premiered, of how weak the final set piece is.
Yeah.
I mean, it's cool that they're fighting at the Statue of Liberty. That in itself is dramatic.
Okay.
But just the gift shop at the museum is kind of lame.
Yeah. And it is weird that Mystique is there, like, as a Statue of Liberty statue.
She can turn into a statue.
Like, she positioned herself there just, like, waiting for them to show up. Like,
she did, yeah.
I don't know.
Well, Magneto sets up it's all an analogy or a metaphor for chess.
Yeah.
So he's putting his chess pieces out there.
Right.
And Professor X is playing his chess pieces.
Yeah.
So they're all in their defensive positions. And at first, the Brotherhood gives the X-Men a really tough fight. Mystique turns into Wolverine, which confuses all of them, and Wolverine has to fight himself, that's actually pretty cool.
Yeah.
Hugh Jackman fighting himself, that's like well-staged, good special effects.
Yeah.
Good, like, fun X-Men trickery and nonsense that we all love about the X-Men.
Right. And there's that one part in the fight where he actually, like, slices off
her claws.
Mystique's Wolverine claws.
And she screams in pain.
Yeah.
Which is weird.
So there you have it. Like, she's not actually...
I don't know. We don't know. We don't know what's going on with the claws.
She's not manufacturing adamantium out of her own
something,
cells.
Something, though. She's making something.
Something that looks like adamantium.
Some part of her body.
But is not.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's like we've talked about before with Mystique's powers. It's like her ability to 3D print clothing.
Yeah.
The claws are almost an extension of that. It's like not part of her. It's part of the clothing in a sense. You know,
but it hurts her when it gets cut.
Or maybe she's surprised. We don't know if she's in pain or if she's surprised that they get cut off.
Okay.
It's hard to say. Anyway, Wolverine, she kicks him in the balls, which is established earlier that he does not like that. And so he ends up defeating her, and he stabs her at some point with the intention of killing her. So that's kind of cool. Wolverine's murderous. It turns out she lives, you know.
Yeah.
Which is a good choice that they didn't kill Mystique. So, that's a very good fight. I like all those scenes of them fighting.
Yeah.
And then it's Toad versus Jean and Cyclops,
and Storm.
Well, and Storm, right? But Storm gets knocked out quick first by Toad.
It's surprising, like, how formidable a fighter Toad is.
Yeah, I know, because he's such a loser in the comics. And I'm basically basing it off the early 60s comics. I didn't read much about Toad later on in the 70s and 80s. I don't know how much he comes back. But in the early 60s comics, he's such a loser, dunce of a weirdo.
Yeah.
He can just hop around. He's an annoying, like, comic relief character. And here, you're right, he's formidable. He hops around, he uses that tongue effectively. He sprays Jean Grey with his gooey venom on her face.
Right, so that she can't breathe.
Right, and can't use her powers.
A bit.
And Cyclops has to save Jean, and in the end, Storm takes out Toad. She essentially kills him, I guess, because he never comes back in the series. So Storm murders Toad. She shoots him with lightning, blasts him with wind, and he falls into the ocean off the Statue of Liberty, which has to be fatal. And, you know, that's the famous line that everyone derides. The one line that Joss Whedon wrote that survived all the subsequent rewrites.
Mm.
You know, what happens to a toad when struck by lightning? The same thing that happens to everyone else. And that's a horrible line. It's horribly delivered. It's just not good. And, of course, and that's Storm's biggest moment in the movie, too.
Yeah.
So it's like, that's why it's such a letdown as well. That, like, her chance to say something, her chance to be, you know, it looks cool enough, but it's just not played well.
It's a little anticlimactic.
The dialogue isn't good. And in the commentary, Bryan Singer's talking to his friend who's with him, and the friend says, you know what the line should have been? It should have been, what happens to a toad when he's struck by lightning? He croaks.
Yeah.
Dun-dun-dun. You know, like, right. Ha-ha-ha. Like, and that is a more clever line.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so.
Oh, well.
Missed opportunity. Sticks out like a sore thumb.
Mm-hmm.
So then they make their way up to the torch area. Magneto captures the X-Men. He binds them in metal. Sabretooth is guarding them. It seems like the X-Men are trapped. And here you had some thoughts about Jean Grey. Like, all the X-Men are fucked. Like, Cyclops, his visor's ripped off his face, and it's pointing at Jean. He's pointing at Jean, so he can't open his eyes. Wolverine's claws are pressed against his heart and chest, so he can't really do much. Storm can't fire her lightning because it's a copper conductor.
Right.
Magneto's having.
So Magneto really, like, has foiled all of them.
Except Jean.
Right.
It's like, Jean can use her power. Jean has the powers of Magneto, except with all objects, not just metal.
Right.
And it's like, so it's either, again, just like the cartoon, she's, like, way weaker than she should be, you know?
Right.
Which I guess is the explanation, that she can't move metal with her mind.
I guess. I don't know.
She could also brain control Sabretooth if she wanted to.
Right. Get him to, like, undo the metal bindings,
because
he's super strong.
Or have him attack Magneto, something.
Right. So, but she doesn't. She just, like, sits there.
Yeah. So that's a plot hole, I think.
Yeah,
I think that's a legitimate
so
plot hole, that Jean is all of a sudden forgets how to use her powers.
Right.
But then Wolverine frees himself in a really cool and gory way. Talk about Quentin Tarantino, like, stabbing himself in the heart and bleeding out on the floor just to release his shackles.
Yeah.
Because he knows he's going to heal. So that leads to a big fight with Sabretooth on top of the Statue of Liberty. A fight I always thought was kind of, like, weirdly just weird. Not done well.
Yeah, the physics of it are not very believable. The way they're both, like, leaping and tumbling around and, like, not falling off the edge.
And the camera following it in such a weird way. I would rather a more static camera to show, like, how high up they are and how, like, dangerous it is to be trying to balance yourself on the head of the Statue of Liberty.
Yeah.
Like, it's almost like you'd want to see them, like, stumbling with their balance and, like, almost falling off the edge and get a sense of vertigo. Instead, the camera's, like, dramatically flying around them in weird CGI ways, and it's
right.
Like a ballet.
It's really, right, it's, like, swooping, and it shows you, like, the view over the edge once or twice just to establish that it's high up.
Yeah.
But I don't know.
It's not done. It's not filmed that well. And then there's that scene where Wolverine slices off a part of the Statue of Liberty crown and manages to balance himself. I never understood the physics of that.
Yeah.
And I never understood that shot. I always thought that was strange.
Right.
But then I think the movie, it keeps saving itself with the dialogue at times. They free themselves and they have to rescue Rogue from Magneto. The mutant changing machine Magnostorm is approaching the leaders at Ellis Island.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's another thing. The fact that it has physical appearance is strange. It should be invisible.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no way that radiation would be visible in the visible spectrum.
Yeah, but where's the
drama? It's a movie, right, yeah. Anyway, so they have to rescue Rogue. I like the dialogue between all the characters where Wolverine's like, just shoot it. And Cyclops is like, she'll die, you know. So they're thinking logically about what their choices are.
Yeah.
And then the option is that they decide to send Wolverine up there to rescue her. Storm's going to create a tornado to shoot him up, and Jean will steady him. It's like, I don't know, why doesn't Storm just fly up there and free Rogue?
Because she's, like, handcuffed, or she's got, like, metal shackles on her, so yeah. I guess the idea is, like, Storm wouldn't be able to do anything once she gets up there.
I guess. But the Wolverine, as we see, he's vulnerable to Magneto's... Magneto still has a little power left, even though most of it's been drained.
Yeah.
And by the way, as he gave his power to Rogue, her hair turns white, making her, you know, giving her that little attribute, which I thought was weird.
Yeah.
Like, why... Just give her the white hair in the beginning, instead of giving...
Having to explain
yeah,
it.
Yeah, that's insane.
Yeah.
Oh, there's another line, another great Wolverine line in the movie, before Magneto goes up to kill Rogue, essentially. Wolverine says, "You're so full of shit. If you're really that righteous, it'd be you in that thing." Mm. And Magneto doesn't even have an answer. Because it's such a great line. And it's like a really, that's great dialogue because it's a movie explaining logic to other members of the audience and other characters in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like, and it's a clever bit of logic explaining.
Right.
And movies are good when they can do that, when they make you think about, like, something, like the reality of a situation.
Well, it also, right, because it's a whole moral dilemma with Magneto, because they do make...
Yeah, Magneto's really portrayed himself as this crusader up to this point, and that he's really the hero. And Wolverine's saying, no, you are the villain. And this is why you're the bad guy.
Right.
And Magneto has no response to him. He's like, Magneto's kind of a coward.
Yeah.
And he's too vain. He's not going to die for his evil plan to come through. He's too, like, self-interested.
Mm.
So that's a great moment. Anyway, they free Rogue. It's a pretty gruesome scene. Rogue seems to be dead, but she's not dead because Wolverine hugs her and her absorbing power still works and she takes his healing power and that's how she lives.
Right.
But a weird, another nitpicky thing, all of Wolverine's wounds from before his fight with Sabretooth, they all open up again and he starts bleeding out of his face and back.
Yeah.
And that doesn't make any sense to me.
Right. Because if they're healed, they're healed.
Yeah. If his body's been repaired, it's been repaired.
Yeah.
He would be hurt by Rogue stealing his life force.
Right.
And he is. He's in a coma, but he eventually gets better, obviously.
Yeah.
So now the movie's wrapping up. The X-Men are all happy back in the mansion. Rogue's back with her friends. Professor X gives Wolverine a tip about his past life in Alkali Lake in Canada to go find out about Weapon X. Jean has a moment with Wolverine again in the hospital bay where they're much sweeter and kinder to each other.
Mm.
And he basically tells her that he loves her. And I don't know, but...
Well, yeah, she starts to say, like, oh, I'm with Scott. And, like, he knows what the answer is, so he, like, cuts her off. He doesn't even want to, like, hear it.
Which is good. That's played well.
Yeah.
And, you know, Wolverine steals Cyclops' motorcycle again. It's revealed that Mystique is now pretending to be Senator Kelly, who we know is dead.
Mm-hmm.
She's going to now be a senator.
Right.
Like, that can't be easy. Wolverine gives Rogue his dog tags. He says, "I'll be back for these." That's a touching moment.
Yeah.
So as much as we derided Rogue character in Anna Paquin's movie, it's all redeemed by Hugh Jackman in a sense. His dialogue and his acting is really good.
Mm-hmm.
He sells the thing they wanted to sell, which is so essential to the character in the comic. His bond with, like, the young female mutant, be it Kitty Pryde or Jubilee. Hugh Jackman creates that bond.
Right.
And so that's a success in that sense. And then we meet the final stinger of the movie is Magneto's in a plastic prison somewhere, some, like, deep military base, and Professor X gets to visit him for some reason, and they talk about the future and their friendship and they're playing chess, and you know, the famous quotes are spoken that they repeat in other movies, like, "What do you do if the government comes looking for your children in the night?" And Professor X says, "I feel a great swell of pity for any poor fool who crosses into my transom," or something, you know, whatever. And Magneto says, "There's a war, and I still intend to fight it." And Professor X says, "And I'll be right there, waiting." Cue the music, end credits in the movie. And, you know, let's jump back into our 16-year-old selves. I was thrilled at the end of the movie. You know, I probably felt a lot of the nitpicks I felt at the time, even as a teenager watching it.
Yeah.
But the fact that they established it all very well, the characters were established, The promise of future movies.
Yeah, that was the main thing.
Yeah.
It was like, oh, this is here to stay.
Yeah, like, what could happen next, you know? It's like, and we all kind of, I think we must have read the press. We knew going into it that it was like a low-key X-Men because it was the first one. They had to give it a try.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like now, oh yeah, this movie's good. It's going to be a hit. It was a hit.
Yeah.
It's like now it's like, who knows what's going to happen next.
Right.
And I just left the theater like walking on air, like springing in my step. Like I couldn't wait for the next one. I needed to see it.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, that's why this movie deserves a lot of credit. It's not as big and as amazing as a movie like Star Wars.
Mm.
But because it's the first of its kind, in a sense, it had that feeling. It was like a new Star Wars, you know, a new universe. Marvel universe done right, done correct. You know, a teaser, a cliffhanger at the end of the movie. You know, all this, like, incredible, like, what's going to happen? And that's been the feeling that's, like, carried all these franchise films up to this day. And people are, you know, they've all got superhero fatigue. They're sick of these movies. It's taken over Hollywood. But you can't underrate the feeling that we all felt at the end of X-Men 1. And that's where it all comes from.
Yeah.
And that's why these movies are still being made to death, you know?
Right. Well, yeah, because they're really trying to capture that same feeling at the end of each of the superhero movies. And it's pretty successfully done, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, despite the fatigue, like, everyone still goes out and spends their money on watching these movies because they're entertaining,
yeah.
You know?
But for lack of a better metaphor, this was the first hit of heroin that got us all hooked.
Yeah.
You know, right. the indescribable rush we felt at the end of this movie where the promise was so much, probably so much better than the eventual payoff.
Yeah, well.
Yeah. Okay, so we've arrived at the end of this momentous bonus episode of the X-Men Task Podcast.
If you're still with us, thank you.
Thank you very much. We'll be doing more of these, so, you know, just strap in. But actually, I mean, the next thing we're going to do, we're going to jump back to season 3 next week. So we'll be back on schedule with your normally scheduled broadcasts. In the meantime, we first have to thank someone, and I'm sorry it's buried at the end of like a 2-hour podcast. We have to thank from the X-Men Task Facebook group, Brandon. He also is a co-host of a show called Through Entirety.
Flight Through Entirety.
Right. Flight Through Entirety. I'm sorry, Brandon. It's a Doctor Who podcast. Likely more popular than ours. They gave us an enormous shout-out on their show. We would have mentioned it weeks ago, but we pre-recorded a lot of these, so we didn't have a chance to until now. But that was amazing and really touched us, and we really thank you. And if you love Doctor Who, you should listen to their podcast. It's amazing, and we just want to thank Brandon and the whole crew there for mentioning us.
Thanks, guys.
Yeah, thank you. And then just our normal other thank yous and goodbyes. Please, if you enjoy the podcast, subscribe to it, rate us 5 stars, leave a review on iTunes. That goes a really long way to spreading the popularity of the show out to potential new listeners.
Raising X-Men TAS awareness.
Yes, raising X-Men TAS awareness, our constant goal. The X-Men TAS Facebook group, please join us, talk to us directly. Let us know all our foibles, or let us know if you love us. That'd be nice, too. Also, follow me on Twitter, @WillieSimpson. Sonia, do you have any last words to say?
That is all my words for today.
Yes, we are all worded out. Let's just say goodnight.
Goodnight.